right, we don't have quorum yet, but we will get started. Welcome to the Health and Human Service Reform Committee. Representative Barr, if you can make your way down. When Representative Barr presents, we will move at that point that House File 1188, the bill that he has up, be referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. Representative Barr, unofficially we have a bill in front of us. Actually, now we do have quorum, so I'll call the meeting officially to order. Representative Cresha moves the minutes from Wednesday, March 8th, 2017. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The minutes from March 8th are adopted. Representative Cresha then moves that the minutes from Thursday, March 9th, 2017 be adopted. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the Thursday, March 9th minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adopting the minutes from Thursday, March 9th, 2017, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted for Thursday, March 9th. And now I will move officially that House File 1188 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Barr, we have the bill in front of us. I understand you have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the A-17.
All right, I will move the A-17 amendment, and this is to get the bill into the form in which you'd like to present it. Are there any questions on the A-17 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A-17 amendment is adopted. Representative Barr, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this is my first time in front of the committee, so I have brought the obligatory treats, if the page would help me out here with that, and up to the bill directly. Here, this is just it's a revenue neutral, but it cleans up the funding formula for how counties are reimbursed for the homeless shelters. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is George Burrell. I'm with Anoka County Social Service and Behavioral Health. Thank you, Representative Barr, Mr. Chair, committee members. To give a little background on this, group residential housing is authorized as on an individual basis by applying for cash assistance with county economic assistance departments. It is common for homeless shelters to rely on group residential housing for a significant portion of their funding to pay for the room and board costs of the adults staying at the shelters. The only adult homeless shelter in Anoka County utilizes group residential housing to fund a portion of its expenditures for its 66-bed facility. During state fiscal year 16, Anoka County's Economic Assistance Department processed a total of 717 paid transactions for group residential housing at our homeless shelter for a total of $371,000. Anoka County employs 1.5 FTE financial workers just to process the group residential housing applications for our one adult homeless shelter. If approved, this bill will allow the Department of Human Services to make a cost-neutral transfer of group residential emergency shelter bed funding to county human service agencies with existing shelters. The funding will be allocated annually and adjusted according to the percentage change in the group residential housing room and board rate. Counties can opt in or choose to continue using individual client eligibility for group residential housing payments at their shelter. For those counties that opt in, a biennial plan will need to be submitted by the county to the DHS commissioner for approval before any transfer of funds occur. The DHS commissioner or a county may return beds to the group residential housing fund with 180 days notice, including financial reconciliation. The outcomes we believe this will achieve are an increase in financial stability for the emergency shelters who rely on this funding, and the administrative simplification will decrease costs associated with the management of GRH for emergency shelters and counties. Thank you for this opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Burrell. Representative Barr, do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Burrell? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1188? Seeing none, final questions from members on House File 1188. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning.
Good morning.
So is there anybody that you're aware of that is opposed to this?
Mr. Burrell.
No, I am not.
Representative Whitman.
That's all. Thank you.
All right. Any final word, Representative Barr?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, I'll renew my motion on House File 1188 as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 1188 as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Barr.
Thank you.
Next up this morning, we have Representative Pearson. I will move that House File 1384 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Pearson. When you are ready, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. House File 1134 really addresses basically a disparity in some of the funding of what we do for specific programs dealing with addictions in the state of Minnesota. Particularly in Olmsted County, we have an adult and teen challenge facility that has a different reimbursement rate than what other similar facilities have throughout the state of Minnesota. I think the key elements that I want to point out before I turn it over to the testifier, I'll try to learn from Cal and keep my comments brief, is that Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge has proven their effectiveness throughout the state, and that we just need to make sure that those resources are offered to people in outstate Minnesota, in greater Minnesota, and that they're also increased the access for women throughout the state of Minnesota. And so I have Tim Walsh here and two Adult and Teen Challenge clients are here to tell you a little bit more about what this supplemental rate could mean for them for securing more long-term funding to successfully get people through addiction programs.
All right, Mr. Walsh, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Tim Walsh, Vice President at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. Thank you, members of the committee. The 104 beds that we are going to have as of October in Rochester are going to serve both men and women. It's long-term group residential housing with supports and treatment. As we look at all the research of what works to help people to break the bonds of addiction and also to transform their lives, we find that longer is better. And we find that just housing all by itself is not going to do it. That our clients, because of their multiple disabilities and life issues, they require that long term and they need numerous supports and treatments. We have done studies through the Weiler Foundation, a number of studies on our services, and we find that our effectiveness rate is anywhere from 74% to 76% in a 6-month follow-up of our graduates. We also find that in our research that our programs help to improve the transition to self-sufficiency and independence, which is the goals of the GRH program. As you look at the whole menu of services provided through group residential housing services across the state, we provide almost all of those services. So not just the four minimum that are required for an exception rate, but almost all of the supports and treatment services that are provided at GRH facilities across the state. To put in perspective our request, 1 month at the highest rate chemical dependency treatment program in the state pays for a whole year at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. The GRH funds pay for less than half of our costs. The rest come through donors and other funds. And we are less costly than a prison bed for 1 year in Minnesota State Prison. So that's why we're hoping for your support today on House File 1384. And our residents, I think, tell the story much better than I do.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Lindsay French. I just want to say good morning, everybody. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm 30 years old, and I've been struggling with addiction for about 12 years. I had a scholarship for hockey, and I decided to drink that away, and that was the beginning, downward spiral for me. I started getting into some harder drugs and became very addicted and started committing crimes, and I ended up in prison 4 times, and then that was the journey of, for the last 6 years, I've been in and out of treatment centers, in and out of jails. It took a toll on me. 2 years ago, I got addicted to heroin, and that kind of took my soul from me. I have a 5-year-old daughter who I want to be in her life, so I decided to do, I have long-term problems, so I need to a long-term treatment center, and I've been to 12 treatments and halfway houses and outpatients, and nothing really clicked because I needed structure for a long period of time. So I entered Teen Challenge last year, and I graduate in June, and it's, like, been a, it's been a total, like, eye-opener for me. I've, like, learned to find my purpose in life. I've had over 10.5 months of sobriety, and that's, it's been, like, 8 years since I've been that sober. And, like, I can think clearly. I have motivation and drive, and I just, like, I feel a change. I don't have to be, like, fear-driven anymore of, like, my past. So I just want to say thank you for listening to me, and have a good day.
Thank you, Ms. French, for your testimony this morning and for sharing your story with us and the effectiveness of the programs that you're experiencing there and being able to do it with such confidence. Really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Victoria Label. I am also from Rochester. I have been, like Lindsay, to over 12 treatments. I suffer from, I've been addicted to methamphetamine and heroin for over 15 years. I think that if there was a program like this down in Rochester, if there was sooner, I think my life would have changed a lot sooner. I entered the program last April up in Minneapolis here, and it's completely changed my life. The 2 years prior to coming to Teen Challenge, I was using heroin every day, and down in Rochester, and there was a couple of sober houses down there that were funded by GRH, but no one there was sober, and I actually lost my boyfriend to a heroin overdose almost a year ago. And that was when I realized that, like, I can't do this anymore, and I needed something long-term because the 30-day treatments that I had been through prior didn't even begin to scratch the surface in changing my life and the root of my problems. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Liebel, for being with us this morning and sharing your story. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone who wishes to testify from the audience on House File 1384? Seeing none, final questions for the bill author. Final word, Representative Pearson.
Thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1384 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 1384 as we refer to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Pearson. Is Representative Metza here?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. Representative Metza, I will move that House File 885 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Metza, when you are ready, please present your bill.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. We did bring a couple things for the committee members here to review. If I could get the committee administrative staff to get these out. I didn't mean you, Representative Dean.
Sure.
All right.
One of each.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That just shows Rangers stick together.
Dang right.
Well, I'm actually very honored to be here today presenting this bill. We've been meeting with a program that Shelley here, who will testify shortly, put together on her own with her own finances. And it's a place called Catherine's House in Eveleth. And we've seen over the course of a few years here many of our programs dissipate. And this was someone who took the initiative, took a problem, and built a solution on her own. And so I think her words and our testifier, Cindy, will speak far better than mine. But we're basically in the bill asking the county to fund this program because it doesn't meet the qualifications. But I think after you hear the services, you'll see why we're asking for this small change in the actual language.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Holmes. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Shelley Holmes, and I'm from Eveleth, Minnesota.
I started a board and lodge with supportive services for women only in Eveleth. I named it after my grandma, Catherine Petrini. So it's called Catherine's House. It's the first time in the history of the Iron Range that there's ever been women-only housing, not to mention with supportive services. We passed around a flyer that kind of just gave a little bit more of a breakdown as to how I feel that we're different from other typical board and lodges, especially in St. Louis County and maybe even statewide. But my company is called Lotus Corporation, and I created a program called the Lotus Strategy, and it is for a long-term wraparound services where we include the key person or people in the resident's life, and we meet once a month with them on an so it's on an ongoing basis. And where we're different is in the typical board and lodge supported by GRH, you have a requirement of 4 hours a week of nursing. We have two full-time nurses, an RN and an LPN, each 40 hours. We find that there's a lot of health concerns and issues, hep C, female issues, chronic pain, etc. And so we try to address all of that. That's very costly. We have a 32-year psychologist on staff. We try to work on, every day we have groups on life skills and parenting skills. I have a building right next door to Catherine's house that I renovated that has a furnished apartment upstairs. And that was designed for the women to be able to have supervised visits, to cook and play games and have activities and stay overnight and reunite with their children and families, to have a second chance to maybe put the family back together, to get the children out of foster care. And if it's the right decision, and throughout the process of the life skills and the parenting skills and the psychology and everything, we could determine that that is the right thing for the children. I'm a firm believer in that. But we struggle with transportation on the Iron Range. And so I have purchased vans and I have drivers, and we're off and running to the horse farm for equine therapy and gardening and as many activities as we can possibly do, taking them out for job interviews to encourage for employment to move on. I don't feel that this was a goal to fill the home and try to keep it full with the same people. The idea was to mentor women, to be strong, independent women, and move on into independent housing with employment and having their children back and be positive role models in our community. So just a real quick, in Catherine's house I have some demographics. The average, we've had 113 residents since we've opened August 8th of 2015. And of those, 19 is the youngest, 60 is the oldest. The average is 23 to 39 years old. Of the 113, 94 had children in foster care. That's huge. 44 did not have legal issues or on probation, but 69 were in the legal system. Probation, you name it, and we're running them continually to court appointments and all of the different things that they need to have. The average stay has been around 3 months when we averaged out the whole thing. We did have, of the 113, 21 stayed less than 15 days. Those were addiction issues where maybe they came in the door and weren't right in that right frame of mind that they were ready to, you know, to make the commitment. But of the 113, 111 have mental health issues. 103 chemical dependency issues. Those are large numbers. And in our area, we have nonprofit outpatient, and this housing setting, I put all my own money and my time and my passion, and I firmly believe that with my LOTUS strategy, the longer the term, that we can either keep them in Catherine's house, then into independent housing, but we have an open door policy where they come back. So we have some of the gals, they come back during the day, we manage their meds. I don't get any money for that, but it has been a success. Here's one right here, which is Cindy Brown. And we manage their meds. They come back on a daily basis, do groups, activities in the home, go to the horse farm, do all of the different items we do, get their meds, and then they go home to independent housing. And I do believe that after a certain amount of time, that too will be that then they can start to be well enough and secure enough of themselves to manage their meds and then take each of those steps on their way out. So I appreciate you all listening. And if there's any questions, there have been politicians that have taken the time, including Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, that visited the home. And you're all welcome at any point if you ever visit the Iron Range. Cindy Brown is a former resident. She came to us homeless. And she's now an employee of Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and they were nice enough to give her the day off for the Senate hearing and for this today. And Cindy has her children back in her life on visits, and I will let her speak.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Holmes, for your testimony this morning and for the work you're doing up on the range there. Ms. Brown, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and tell us your success story.
My name is Cindy Brown. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Last July, I found myself homeless. I had no place to go, no safe place to go. Every friend I knew on the Iron Range were using friends. I had no place to go. If I would not have found Shelley's house, I'm a veteran. I was a former Marine, and Matt B. in Duluth actually told me about Catherine's house and got me a referral there to go stay. When I showed up at Catherine's house in Eveleth, I had a clothes basket and a suitcase full of clothes, and that was all I had left to my name. Addiction had taken a toll in my life. If I had not gone to Catherine's house that day, I would be dead right now. I know this for a fact. The Iron Range is not a safe place for women that have no place to go. Yes, there's homeless shelters, but there's no women-only place. When I went to Shelley's house, I felt safe. It's a safe, sober house. It's a home, not a facility. When I first walked in the doors, I actually felt at home, that I was going to be safe, that nothing was going to happen to me. Through Shelley's kindness and the services she offers, I go to therapy with her therapist, Steve. He's excellent. I found a job at Blue Cross Blue Shield. I'm a customer service rep on the Senior Gold and Platinum Blue Line. I have had 2 promotions. I've had a raise. I'm a success story. I'm one of the rare successes that has succeeded. I'm also in a phase 2 where I'm in independent living through Shelley
in
one of her apartments. And because of this facility, I'm myself again. During addiction, a person loses themselves and they don't remember who they are or they don't remember how to be a person. But through her facility, I remembered who I was, my education. I have a degree in criminal justice and in industrial engineering. I have forgotten how to spell big words. I've forgotten everything. But through the healing, through therapy, and just time, I've actually become myself again. I actually consider myself better because now I don't have to worry about if I'm going to be safe or what I'm going to eat. Now, what I earn at my job, I can spend on groceries, clothing, whatever I'd like. I'm a human again. And during addiction, a person doesn't feel like they're human. They feel they're less than human. And so many women on the Iron Range don't know of Catherine's house. They have no place. They don't know where they could go. They don't feel safe, so they just turn back to their using friends. And a lot of them I know are overdosing and they're dying. Now, if Catherine's house can get the finance they need and extend their services, so many women on the Iron Range will be saved like I have been. and I owe my life to Shelley, and I am eternally grateful for the help she has given me. And I'd like to, I'm not ashamed of what my life was. I'd like to tell people, I've actually told the people at work, my bosses, they are the ones that let me off for today. And I've proudly told my story. And that's why I'm here today telling you my story, so hopefully we can get the financing help that Shelley needs for her home. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown, for sharing your story with us this morning. That's quite a life change that you've had there. We have a couple questions for the two of you this morning. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, congratulations, Ms. Brown, on your recovery.
Thank you.
Your journey. You were there for a reason, and you're paying it forward now.
Yes.
Thank you for that. And again, Ms. Holmes, thank you for opening the home. There isn't enough of these on the Iron Range. I know that. I don't know if I did you say why you opened it up in the first place? I was wondering if I could have that story, because there's a reason you did this, too. I think the committee should hear what that is.
Ms. Holmes.
Yes. I'm self-employed. I'm a trucking company. I'm a woman minority contractor. And my family's in the scrap iron business, and I've had issues for 29 years of keeping people employed and people with addiction and dysfunction. So I own a lot of rental properties, and I was always going to start a work release program when I got to a certain point. And so what I did is the county was in need of, we discussed the women only, and after my research and trying to figure everything out, I thought that that would be the best stepping, you know, to start with. I already owned the building, so I have an 8,600-square-foot building that I renovated completely to look like a home and put a lot of effort into it. If you go to our website, you can kind of see all the pictures of the tongue and groove wood and everything. Homemade quilts on every bed and put a lot of effort into it. I have a son with addiction issues, and we've struggled for a very long time. And throughout all the research, I found that I couldn't try to save him or, you know, do it. So I put all my effort into trying to help women and other families and created this program and supportive services so that there would be services for the time when my son was ready to help himself and want to save himself, which, by the way, he is sober and doing very, very well, and other people that I've helped. So I guess I'm very blessed. I've been a hardworking farm girl from northern Minnesota, and all I know how to do is work, and I just wanted to give back and be able to do something for my community.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for that, and thank you for what you do. You are truly a hero. You are life-saving. I'm someone also who is heavily involved in addiction recovery services and things out in Wilmer and the area out there. We support a lot of sober homes as well for both men and women. And again, we all have our story of addiction, but thank you so much. Representative Metza, thanks for bringing them here today. Thanks.
Any other questions for these testifiers? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not a question but a comment for Ms. Holmes and Representative Metza. Thanks for bringing this forward. I also had a chance to visit Catherine's. Right, and as you describe it, it is a place where you feel like you're at home. As you describe, homemade quilts, separate bedrooms for people. But what I remember the most was your determination to make a place that was safe for people, but also that you had very high expectations for the women that were coming there. You had I don't like the phrase tough love, but you had that attitude. Like, you break the rules, you're not going to stay, but you're always welcome back as long as you follow the rules here. And I remember the pairing of your desire to see the people coming through those doors succeed and your high expectations for them and your determination that they do it right. And I think that's why you're so successful. And I'm really glad you're here before the committee today. Thank you for telling that story, and thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too want to express my thanks for Representative for bringing it forward, but your dedication, not enough of that is available for people, and we certainly want to see success. And I'm curious, the counselors that are they on staff just for your facility, or do they live in the area? And then are you able to hire enough people to help counselors?
Ms. Holmes.
Yes, thank you for asking those questions. They are local. I was able to hire Stephen Taylor, a 32-year psychologist who believed in my mission. I'm big on what I call my mission. And he believed in my rural farm setting and using the horses and the animals and all of the different things and teaching them to cook. And I love to feed everybody. So it wasn't hard. I had actually a lot of people. I was hiring 4 at one time and had 47 apply, from resident aides to psychologists, because I really believe what I found, and I was simply amazed, is that they wanted something fresh, something new, and they believed in my mission of what I was trying to do. And a lot of them told me that they liked that there was one person running it. There wasn't a huge board. It wasn't a nonprofit. They figured I was going to be around and really put a lot of effort into it because I spent all of my own money. There was no grant money. There wasn't anything else. The resident aides, as we call them, resident counselors, the day-to-day staffing, I'm not going to say there is. It's not challenging there. There are many waiting. As soon as one goes, there's 2 or 3 wanting to come because they seem to want to be part of helping women. It's finding the right women to be resident counselors that has been a little challenging for me, but I'm not a licensed person in that. I'm from the trucking industry. I can tell you about Cat engines, but so I needed to go out and hire the best, and so I did. I researched and I interviewed and I put together a lot of. I have staff that are have degrees in psychology, social work, LADCs. And they have advised me along the way, I think, very well. And I pay them well, and they put a lot of effort into helping me really build this into what it was. Because I had an idea. I wrote my mission out. But I didn't know the rules, regulations, and compliance part of it. Mm-hmm. So I needed to hire for that.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also to Representative Metz and the testifiers. And there's several things, sorry for the call, several things that really stand out to me, and I hope that we're paying attention to what's working, because number one, you said equine therapy. I've been working with different groups and working on sex trafficking and getting women out of the life. And one of the things that we're looking at doing in my area in St. Cloud is creating a home, and it's going to be called Terebinth House. And basically it includes equines and that relationship. But it's also creating homes. And I think it's bringing back the normalcy that a person needs to get through the addiction. And I'm also seeing that we're putting them back on the farm. You know, we talk about all this natural stuff and the technology and the clinics. And I'm thinking what we're seeing is, what's working is putting them back on the farm. Getting connected with just quietness and nature, and we're talking about animals, and I hope we're paying attention to this because I think this is huge, and we're missing the boat on this one. I think we should be looking at folks that are interested in doing this outside in the country. I mean, well, this isn't exactly a metropolis. But you see a lot of community coming forward, too, and I think these are great, encouraging things for our smaller rural areas to be doing great work. But I also, as a business person, see that this is what private business people do. They have a problem. You had a problem. Basically getting people to work for you and to have housing and things, and you take care of it. And I just can't congratulate you enough for what you've done. But I hope that we're paying attention to this, that we're looking at some of the components that we've seen a couple times over, and that this is what works. If we're looking for models that work, I think we have to kind of, and in a way, take a step backward. You know, not necessarily do we need the clinics and the sterile environments, and I think we're seeing that in other avenues too, but we need to get it back to a more normal environment. And for that, I thank you. I think we have a lot of lessons to learn from what you've done. And I really hope that we're paying attention to what we're seeing here. And thank you so much for bringing this forward, Representative Metza. I'm glad that you're here today.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Kreshaw. excuse me. Are there any other questions from the members for the testifiers? Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Representative Metza. My question maybe is more to staff. I was trying to look and see if I kind of remember that maybe the Office of the Legislative Auditor did a report, some kind of an evaluation about group residential housing. And because we had here today several bills on group residential housing, and, you know, I always wonder about, you know, coming to the legislature, having to find a legislator and do a bill and come here and do this whole process. You know, this is an issue, of course, addiction and treatment and how we're handling, you know, whether we're getting people what they need to recover. And this is just a huge statewide issue. And I know the members of this committee, we're all very passionate about doing that and making sure that it works. We know we have a huge problem. And I think all of us really want to support different models and so that individuals find what they need to recover and, you know, these kinds of great programs. But as a matter of sort of a overarching policy for the state, I just wonder, you know, why we have a system where we're making people come to legislature, you know, and do these kind of one-off, we need help to keep our program going kinds of, you know, why are we putting you in that situation? So it isn't really a question for you, but I guess more it's more for staff or if any of the other members know if the Office of the Legislative Auditor has done something on this to give us sort of an overview because, you know, as I'm looking at all these materials, I'm sort of trying to figure out why do we pay this one this much and this one this much and, you know, how do we get our arms around this because, you know, this is another one of those areas where, and of course this is the policy committee, not the finance committee, but we have limited dollars and we want to make sure that we spread them appropriately to make sure we make the absolute best use of every dollar. So maybe can staff respond? I couldn't find anything quickly on the website.
Ms. Pinelli.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure if the legislative auditor has done something on group residential housing recently. I'm not thinking of anything off the top of my head, but I can certainly go back and check.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Pugnelli. I think that would be really helpful for us because, you know, it's as policymakers, we want to make sure that we don't make people come hat in hand to make great programs actually have the funding to stay afloat. And on the other hand, we want to make sure that we have the programs we need where we need them and using our dollars in the most effective way. So, you know, I hope we can find out about this and maybe as these bills move forward to the Finance Committee, have a little more overall structure to try to understand a little bit better what we're doing overall. Thanks.
Any other questions for Representative Metza or the testifiers? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify in House Bill 885? Final word, Representative Metza.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for the consideration and comments today. I appreciate it. Like I said in my opening statement, I think this program speaks for itself, and without the dedication from Shelley and her drive with that personal story, which thank you both for sharing yours. It's an honor to be here representing issues like this. This is where, you know, we watch the partisan divide in my mind kind of disappear and look for where the rubber meets the road and hope that as we move forward that folks can continue to grow in my community because I know it'll stay the same right now currently as it is, but I think if we can access that funding that we can move in a whole different way. And this started actually 4 years ago, members. And we're looking for different creative ways to figure out how to, you know, finance it and finally kind of came to terms with, I think we just need to be able to access some of the same money that other programs are because we got one that's working. So with that, thank you for your time and consideration, and I'll look forward to answering any other questions for those of you on the Finance Committee.
All right. With that, I'll renew my motion that House Bill 885 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House Bill 885 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Metza, for your bill this morning. Okay, next up we will bring up House File 1522, Representative Allen. And I will, and Representative Allen moves that House File 1522 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Allen, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is to increase the number of beds under the current moratorium on development of group residential housing beds from 190 to 226 for supportive housing units for homeless adults with mental illness, history of substance abuse or HIV/AIDS in Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, or Ramsey County. And I have testifiers here today, Mr. Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Peterson, and I serve as Executive Director of Claire Housing, and we're located in Minneapolis. Claire Housing is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to ensure that all people living with HIV have access to affordable housing and the supports needed to maximize their health and housing outcomes. We serve approximately 200 people every year, and our housing programs include 24/7 care in four adult foster care home settings. We have a home care program supporting approximately 35 individuals in their own apartments, and an independent living program which includes over 40 scattered site housing programs here in Minnesota. Having a safe and affordable place to live is important in everybody's quality of life, but unfortunately we continue to see very low-income people living with chronic illnesses like HIV choosing between rent, food, and medicine. Having stable housing, clean water, and food makes it dramatically easier to maintain one's health, manage their medications, and stay healthy. Housing truly empowers people's ability to take control of their lives, their health care, and their future. This is especially true for people living with HIV. We know that stable housing works, and we see it every day in our work at Claire Housing. We see strong health outcomes, including 87% of our residents achieving undetectable viral loads compared to 63% of people living with HIV in Minnesota and 35% of people living with HIV in the United States. We also see that 90% of our residents maintain their housing for at least 12 months with an overall average length of stay of 3.5 years, when they often reach a point where they can secure their own long-term stable housing on their own. And finally, we see how stable housing is helping many of our residents turn around and pay it forward by sharing with others the knowledge, hope, and confidence they have gained by being stably housed. GRH has been a lifeline for many of our long-term homeless residents, but the way it is structured doesn't always provide the ladders out of poverty that we all hope it will, as well as allow individuals to live independently. There are three ways in which the market and outside forces have limited its effectiveness. First, GRH was designed to be used in a group setting where someone took care of all your basic needs and controlled the funding to do so, and it wasn't designed for independent living, something we all know is a key towards self-sufficiency. Second, rental subsidies have stagnated, and as a consequence, rental supports have been increasingly difficult to obtain for those who are very low income. As a result, providers lack the tools and supports to help homeless and very low-income people transition into independent living settings. And third, an individual has to give up all but $97 of their income in order to gain access to GRH supports. This limits choice. It limits a person's ability to move out of poverty, and again, often results in making choices between food, medical attention, and other basic necessities of life. Claire Housing is proposing to take the existing GRH Metro demonstration project to scale by raising the current cap by 36 units. This has been a very successful project that has demonstrated how structuring GRH funding to be more like rental assistance, where an individual pays 30% of their income towards rent, can improve long-term housing stability. We believe as a result of this small technical change, we'll be able to experience higher success rates keeping people housed and maximizing their independence and reducing the public costs incurred as a result of being homeless. Claire Housing strongly supports House File 1244, and want to thank you for hearing it today. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Peterson? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Appreciate
your being here and so on. I'm not sure if you're the right person to answer the question, but again, I'm just sort of looking at the bill, and this is an exception to the moratorium on development of group residential housing beds. So I just wonder if maybe you or maybe staff could give us a little bit of the background of why we have a moratorium in the first place that forces you to come here and ask for an exception to the moratorium.
Right.
Mr. Peterson?
I'll defer to DHS staff if they're able to respond to that question.
All right. Is there someone from the department who can make their way down? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Christine Davis from DHS and the Housing Support Services Division. The moratorium on the development of supplemental services for GRH has been in existence since the beginning of the Group Residential Housing Act in the 90s and was a result of containing costs.
Representative Weaver.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that's not too surprising, I guess. But so how's that going?
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we recognize a lot of requests for additional funding as a result of having a moratorium. So we see you frequently.
Representative Liebling.
So thank you. So do you have any guidance for us? How are we supposed to, you know, what standard are we supposed to use? I'm assuming, I mean, this sounds great, what he's presenting, and, you know, we all want to say sure and just pass the bill along. That's what we do here, it seems, most of the time. And but how are we to evaluate these kinds of requests? Do you have any suggestions?
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the department has conducted two studies on the supplemental service structure that we have in group residential housing. And so we do have recommendations with conversations that we've had with stakeholders across the state about what could we, if we were to do something differently, what would we do? And recognizing that individuals have different needs, and so having a structure that would support people's needs in different types of settings at different levels of care is something that would be beneficial to address those needs. And so we can share the report with you that we submitted. The most recent one was in December of 2016.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that would be helpful. I just find it really, it's really tough. I don't know, you know, we all, there's a lot of person time that comes and sits around this table. And this isn't just really to you, but just sort of to the committee. You know, we spend a lot of our life energy here trying to do the best work we can for the state. And often it just feels like we don't have any context for the decisions we're trying to make here. And so, you know, here we're hearing a bunch of bills on group residential housing, and it would be really helpful, I think, and maybe this is more to the chair, you know, to kind of give us as a committee some context so that we can make the best decisions and not just say, yeah, you're in front of our committee and we like what you're saying, and yes, yes, we want to say yes to everything. And, you know, wish we could really say yes to all of these great programs and people who come and make presentations, but I think we need a little help sometimes because we do actually have to choose and we have to make priorities. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Are there any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1522? Seeing none, final word, Representative Allen.
Nothing further, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your consideration of the bill.
All right. With that, Representative Allen renews her motion that House File 1522 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prefails, and House File 1522 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Allen. Next, members, we're going to go out of order just slightly and take up House File 919. Representative Peterson, and Representative Peterson, as she's making her way forward, moves that House File 919 be re-referred to the General Register. And I understand there is an A1 amendment, Representative Peterson.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson moves the A1 amendment. Representative Peterson to the amendment.
The amendment basically just continues family access to other essential services, and is this is our first committee stop, so we're just getting the bill in the order we'd like.
All right. Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 919 is a Department of Human Services policy bill related to the early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention benefit for children with autism spectrum disorders, also known as EIDBI. Basically, this bill is specific to establishing standards for recently launched benefit for children with autism or related conditions. The department has been working closely with providers, families, and others for over a year to craft this legislation. The goal of this bill is to increase access to services for these children and their families. And I do have a testifier here that maybe can go over a little bit more of the bill, and I also have the department available for questions.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm very pleased to be with you today talking about a bill that we have spent a lot of time with many stakeholders to get in a shape that will really be able to help children with autism in Minnesota. And thank you to Representative Peterson for authoring this bill. EIDBI, which we have been using for short because the Early Intensive Developmental and Behavioral Intervention is kind of a long name, but this is a very unique benefit. We are making this available to children, actually all the way up through age 21, who have autism or related condition, to be able to offer a unique set of services that is not just a one set of service in Minnesota, but we're taking a unique approach, and we are allowing clinicians through a comprehensive assessment to determine what is the best service for these children and to document progress. And we're going to be able to learn a lot over time about what interventions work best and how. The original legislation was passed in 2013. We received federal approval in 2015, and this bill is bringing some changes to the program in order to make sure that it's widely available. There are some different changes that we need to do. One, we want to update eligibility criteria. As we negotiated with the federal government for this bill, there were some changes, including extending the eligibility to age 21, which is consistent with the special education time period that students can also be in school. And it adds related conditions. So, for example, a child with fetal alcohol syndrome who potentially may benefit from some of the same treatments is able to receive that as well. It adds provider standards to make it clear in law who is able to provide the services. And this is important because actually what we have in our federal agreement with CMS is higher, and the many providers aren't able to meet it. So we've spent quite a bit of time with providers being able to better describe what we are looking for and making it more practical. It creates protections for children and families, and it also retains and requires certain recipient rights, such as having injury reports, copies of the treatment plan, just things that are important for families. It also, in this bill, lists the treatments that are approved by the program, kind of the range of benefits that a clinician can consider, and it sets up a process. So as we learn more, and as there's emerging technologies, we can incorporate them into the benefit. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, it allows us to have exceptions to provider standards and some of the enrollment procedure process while we have a provider shortage. And I'm sure you've heard from many testimony during this session that many parts of the state it's difficult to hire people with the qualifications that we need. So this would allow us to say where there's a shortage, have exemptions so that we can provide alternative standards or alternative requirements while we build up the capacity. We're able to do some of this with the use of a stakeholder group so we can be working with people who are experienced in the field as well as families. That group has been established through the state register process. We're having our first meeting at the end of the month. So we are ready to get to work and being able to make the changes to this program. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Bartolik, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for Ms. Bartolik? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bartolik, thank you very much. And I know this is a product of a lot of work. And I really appreciate that we've come a long way on some of this stuff as a state. I just was thinking about the parents who came before us somewhat recently. Maybe it was in the Finance Committee, but the TEFRA issue. You know, the parents who are paying the extra fees to be able to have the Medicaid package of services. I'm assuming that these services are one of the things, even if we're not able to, I hope we can reduce the fees the parents are paying, but this enhances what they get for those fees. Am I correct in thinking that?
Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, this is a benefit that when somebody is on medical assistance or through the TEFRA program, a child will be able to receive this benefit.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Bartolik? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 919? Seeing none, final questions from members? Final word, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your support.
With that, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 919, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 919, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Now we'll go back to our order and bring up House File 1445, Representative Lohmer. As she makes her way forward, Representative Lohmer moves that House File 1445 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Lohmer, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 1445 proposes to expand and improve our consumer-directed community supports program so Minnesotans with disabilities can meet their housing and employment goals. Currently, 5,000 individuals on waiver programs are utilizing CDCFs. Those individuals receive an annual budget, develop a support plan approved by the counties, are held accountable by working with a fiscal support entity, but then have greater flexibility in developing their customized service and supports. Individuals on CDCFs express a high level of satisfaction with their services. However, there are some barriers that exist in the program that create some disincentives for individuals considering utilizing the CDCFs. House File 1445 will address those distinct disincentives so more Minnesotans can benefit from having greater control over the resources available to them. So testifying with me today in support of the bill are Deborah Bailey and Steve Larson with ARC, Minnesota.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Deborah Bailey. I live in Chaska, and I'm on a caddy waiver. I'm here today to testify in favor of House File 1445 to expand and improve consumer-directed community supports. I would like to have more choices and more control over my care and my services. I have a traumatic brain injury as a result of a car accident. It was just another day. I was on my way to work in January 2012 when I lost control of my SUV after hitting a patch of ice. I spent the next year relearning how to walk, talk, use a knife and fork, tie my own shoes, read a book, and do pretty much everything else in life. I still live with significant impairments in visual processing, planning and decision-making, and energy management, as well as some other deficits. There are a number of reasons why I support CDCS, and I'd like to share some of those with you. While I do want more choices, I am not able to take on significantly more responsibility for overall management of my services. I do not want to be solely responsible for finding and employing caregivers.
While I believe I would be able to get some of my services and supplies at a lower cost, I'm concerned about the significant budget reduction I would face. Under current law, I would take a 30% reduction in my current waiver budget to get on CDCS. I believe this approach discourages independence and encourages paternalism. I would like to have a better understanding of my rights and my options under the waiver program. Whenever I have expressed this desire, I have been asked to identify a specific problem to be addressed, or I have been told CDCS wouldn't be appropriate for your situation. With the help of a support planner, I think CDCS would be very appropriate for my situation. I would like more control in choosing caregivers with whom I work well. I would like an easier way to address issues with caregivers. I would like more flexibility in scheduling caregivers. I would like the flexibility to arrange changes directly with the caregiver when holidays, appointments, or other scheduling conflicts occur, or when I would simply like to arrange a particular outing or activity. I would like to encourage more communication between my caregivers. Currently, this is not permitted due to privacy concerns and company policies. I'd also like to share two specific examples of issues that I've recently had with caregivers. My independent living skills worker, who typically comes twice a week, was unable to come for 11 weeks last year because of a lapse in the company's license. This caused a significant disruption in my life, and I believe this is a situation that could have been avoided had it been on CDCS. I have weekly skilled nursing visits. Among other things, the nurse helps me manage my chronic conditions. Consistency in this effort is very important to me. During a recent 7-month period, I worked with 8 different nurses. I need more consistent care in order to be successful. When I complained to the company, they promised that they would improve their consistency. They didn't. I eventually asked my case manager for help to change providers in order to resolve this situation. This is another challenge that I believe could have been avoided by using CDCS. Studies have documented a high level of satisfaction for individuals on CDCS. They have also shown that staff turnover is reduced because more of the budget can go into paying higher wages to staff. So I'm asking that you please pass House File 1445 so individuals like me can have greater control over our services and supports. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey, for your testimony this morning. Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and I'm also here on behalf of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, and House File 1445 is one of the 3 priority bills that the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities is working on this year. As was stated, there are 5,000 people on consumer-directed community supports, but there are certain barriers there, such as the 30% discount that Deborah referred to, that are preventing other individuals from getting on to CDCS. Individuals that graduate from high school or turn 21 and want additional resources to help them with their individualized employment or individualized housing needs have had limited options to get increases in their budget. Last year, we passed a 20% increase for supported or employment, individualized employment, but that doesn't apply to housing and other needs that individuals need, and that's why we're back here today. This is a package piece of legislation because it goes along with the MSA housing assistance that you have reviewed. It goes along with employment services that you'll be hearing later this morning in this committee. And it also goes along with our Best Life Alliance legislation that will be heard in Representative Dean's committee this afternoon. Because there needs to be 100 different solutions to how we address our direct support professional workforce crisis. Giving an increase such as a wage increase such as the Best Life Alliance legislation calls for is one of those ways. Another way is to utilize individuals to help support persons with disabilities through consumer-directed community supports that wouldn't normally be a support person for a person with disabilities. But the CDCS option provides many opportunities for utilizing informal supports, hiring the neighbor, working with relatives, those types of things that aren't necessarily available in our formalized system. So we're very excited to support changes in this, and we think instead of 5,000, there should be 10 or 15,000 people on our waiver programs that are taking advantage of this if we can break down some of those barriers. There's three important components in this bill that address the problems that exist in the Consumer Directed Community Supports Program. One, the first part of the bill calls for increasing funding through CDCS for those individuals that are in some of our institutions, such as Anoka or St. Peter, or in our crisis beds, and who have not been able to find placements in the community. And so by looking at CDCS as a solution to that, we think we could get individuals out of those institutional placements quicker than we currently are. We're looking at expanding an exception process for CDCS for individuals that in their person-centered plans desire to pursue individualized housing, individualized employment, or a positive support intervention program. And so this would allow an exceptions process so they could get up to 30% more in their individualized budget that they have. And finally, we're looking at developing a new budget methodology that will address many of these issues. And so this would be a multi-year process in moving forward with a report to the legislature on how we can better develop a budgeting process that works more effectively for all the individuals on our waiver programs. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about the consumer-directed community supports and with the opportunity to address these improvements.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Larson and Ms. Bailey, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for our testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1445? Final call for questions. Final word, Representative Lohmer.
It's a great bill. Thank you for your support.
With that, Representative Lohmer renews her motion on House File 1445. It will be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 1445. It's referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Lohmer. Next up this morning, members, we have House File 1386, Representative Albright. And as he makes his way forward, Representative Albright moves that House File 1386 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Albright. 2-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1386 is with regard to housing. And I have a testifier with me, and in light of the time that we have, I will make my remarks brief so that my testifier can explain the bill. But members, we live in an era of unprecedented change within the disability services industry. With home and community-based services, with the Olmstead Plan, Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, 245D licensing, as well as workforce crisis. One of the biggest changes is the DWRS disability waiver rate system, which was enacted in 2014. Thankfully, the legislature put a 5-year banding period in place. Presumably, the 5-year banding period was to allow time to work out the bugs and provide an adjustment period. Under banding, a recipient's rate couldn't go up or down more than 0.5% in each of the first 2 years, and 1% in each of the next 3 years, but we're now in the fourth year of that 5-year adjustment period, and few, if any, of the bugs have been worked out. The rate formula is seriously flawed. The goal with 1386 is to ensure that access to quality services continues uninterrupted for people served as we work our way through this morass of unprecedented change, with the emphasis being on protecting the people being served. This protection only applies to day service recipients who will see rate cuts exceeding 5%. I won't go any further. I'm happy to stamp your questions, but I will turn over the remainder of my time to Mr. Weaver, who is my testifier this morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. We heard every word you had to say there. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Weaver. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Weaver. I'm the CEO of Achieve Services, and we are a day training and rehabilitation program in Blaine. And we serve about 190 adults with developmental disabilities in and around Anoka County. Roughly 54% of the people we serve work in jobs in the community. We also serve a number of very high needs people who are non-ambulatory, non-verbal, people who need assistance with very basic daily functions. 51 of the clients that we serve have been with us for 25 years or longer. Achieve has been around for over 50 years. As Representative Albright indicated, this is a time of unprecedented change in this industry. In addition to the changes he identified on the policy side, we also are in a time when DHS is carving out the employment services that we provide and will be setting new rates for those. And we recently learned that the non-employment services that we provide will also be carved out and new rates will be set for those. So there's just a ton of uncertainty in this industry right now. And in light of that, we've been having meetings for the last couple of years with the parents and families of the people we serve, and I just can't tell you enough how much frustration and anger and confusion there is, and people are frightened about the future services for their loved ones. But the biggest problem, biggest challenge that we face right now is the DWRS, the new rate system. And Representative Albright indicated that that system is flawed. It is. DHS's own report indicates that 63% of service recipients will be seeing a rate cut under this new system. For the people we serve at Achieve, on average, they will be experiencing a 34% rate cut. And again, we're in the fourth year of a five-year banding period. Thank God that the legislature put that banding period in place to give us some time to work out some of the bugs. But we're in the fourth year. And the bugs still exist. What we're trying to do here is provide a softer landing for the people who are getting hurt the worst under this new system. The way it's looking right now under current law, if you're experiencing a 34% cut, after the five-year banding period, you will have lost 4%. So on January 1st of 2019, you will see another 30% cut, which is just not sustainable. So what this bill does is for those who are losing more than 5% of their rates, when you get to that cliff in 2019, instead of seeing a 30% cut, you would continue to lose 1% a year until you get to that new rate. So again, it's essentially a parachute for people who are getting hurt the worst. We know that everybody's going to be stepping out of the plane, and we know that they're going to hit the ground sooner or later. We're trying to give them a little more time in the air and a softer landing when that happens by phasing in this cut over a longer period of time. This, again, provides a safety net and some stability for people with disabilities who, through no fault of their own, are experiencing significant, again, greater than 5% cuts. It helps ensure that individuals with the biggest rate cuts will continue to have access to the services that they choose. It brings some simplicity to an extremely complex environment. It's a commonly used grandfathering concept. It helps the rate losers without taking away from the rate winners. If the DWRS formula is adjusted, and there's other legislation that would do that, that hopefully will reduce the number of people who are losing more than 5% and reduce the number of people who need this protection, but there still are going to be some. It also creates a strong incentive for providers to maintain high-quality services and keep those people in our programs, and it moves the state toward the CMS goal of more uniform rates in a much less disruptive manner. Should also point out that we're not asking to increase anybody's rates or put new money into people. We are asking to slow down the reduction in their rates. And finally, I would just also add that this proposal is being supported by MNFAC, which is the Minnesota Family and Advocates Coalition, which is a statewide network of families and parents of people that we serve. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Weaver, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for Mr. Weaver, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Weaver. This isn't really so much a comment to you, but I just was really interested in your use of your metaphor about stepping out of the plane, and it just really reminded me that our whole state, I think rather than stepping out, which implies there's a voluntary action involved, we're going to be pushed out of the plane. The whole state is going to be pushed out of the plane with regard to Medicaid. We're going to be pushed out by Republicans in Congress and the administration. And I just hope that we all have some kind of a parachute I mean, this is going to be very, very serious. What you're describing, which is, you know, happening now, just under current law, I just have a feeling that we ain't seen nothing yet. Mm. So I hope we can find parachutes. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Weaver? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably more comment from Representative Albright and from Mr. Weaver. As I understand this in very simple terms, what we're hoping to do is to spread out the impact of what has been a reduction in rates over time. So we want to stretch that duration out, make it a little easier. And so for us, I think when we get to finance and to the next committee, we're going to have to consider that in terms of the upcoming budget and then the tails. Mm-hmm. And, we're going to have a devil of a job in that committee trying to balance the requests that are coming in, especially when what we expect to see is a fairly significant tax cut target as well. So I just am going to urge you, if this is important, to make sure and continue to put pressure on the leadership of the body, because they're the ones who are going to make those decisions about where we spend our scarce resources. If we put them into things like this or if we put them into tax cuts, I think you're making a strong argument for evening out the impact on that this would be a rate reduction for people with disabilities who are counting on us. But we're going to need your help to make that case up in the leadership corner, because I don't think I can successfully make it on my own.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. We will be there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wheatley and Representative Murphy. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1386? Any final questions for the bill author or Mr. Weaver? Final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your consideration of this bill this morning.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 1386 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1386 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Albright. All right, and next we will move to skip order just a little bit. House File 1239, Representative Albright. Just one more into the pile. House File 1239, and Representative Albright moves that House File 1239 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And members, it would be my intent that we would recess in about 10 minutes so that we can make our way to the floor. Representative Albright, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1239 establishes three new employment support services that Minnesotans with disabilities could access through the four disability waivers that have been available here in Minnesota. Here in Human Services Reform Committee, as well as in various settings across the state, there are important conversations taking place about how we as a state can address current identified barriers to Minnesotans with disabilities living meaningful lives in our communities based on their own choices about where and how they live, learn, and work, and play. This bill moves our state towards this goal by establishing support services that Minnesotans with disabilities could access as they work to find and keep community employment. I have with me today two testifiers to speak very briefly about the importance of this bill, Lynn Norn, with RISE, as well as Andrea Zuber with Dakota County. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Chair Schumacher and committee members, my name is Lynn Norn, and I am the president of RISE, an organization that provides community inclusion and employment services, serving nearly 3,000 people with a variety of different abilities throughout the Twin Cities and central Minnesota. I'm here today to testify briefly in support of House File 1239 on behalf of RISE as well as on behalf of our broader Day and Employment Service Provider Association, MORE. As you are all aware, from the Olmstead Plan to new federal rules about what community-based disability services will look like in the future, to new federal rules about the path that young people with disabilities will take as they prepare to leave school and enter the workforce, there are many interrelated initiatives that are currently pushing us as a state to have increased flexibility and options for Minnesotans with disabilities as they pursue meaningful lives in our communities. The bill before you today represents a concrete step forward towards this shared goal by establishing both the policy and funding infrastructure necessary to create a set of three new supports that Minnesotans with disabilities can access to secure more community-based employment opportunities. These services will help youth especially to bypass services in the future that can often be difficult to exit. The three new employment services established in this bill are as follows. The first is employment exploration services, which are community-based orientation services that introduce a person to competitive employment opportunities in their community through individualized educational activities, learning opportunities, work experiences, and support services. The second are employment development services, which are individualized services that actively support a person to achieve paid employment in their community. Employment development assists people in finding paid employment, becoming self-employed, or establishing a microenterprise business within their community. The third service is employment support services, which are individualized services that help people with maintaining paid employment in community businesses. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill address how the new employment services will differ from currently available services. Essentially, this is a section of the bill that clarifies that these new employment services will not be provided as a component of day training and habilitation and will be billed separately in the future. Sections 3 through 8 make technical changes to support the provision of these new services, again related to the separation of these services from day training habilitation. Sections 9, 10, and 11 outline components of how the rates for these new services will be determined in DWRS, or the Disability Waiver Rate System. And the 12th and final section of the bill instructs the state to seek necessary federal approval and proceed with creating these three new services. We know that the state legislature will be faced with many difficult decisions this session about how to use very limited state funds in a more cost-effective and impactful way. We hope that you will view this particular piece of legislation as a very important and tangible step that you can make to move our state forward. We ask that you support these services, which will support Minnesotans with disabilities to have meaningful and more independent lives in our communities based on their own choices about where they live, learn, work, and play. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Lauren, for your testimony this morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Sure. My name is Megan Zeilinger, not actually Andrea Zuber. She was unable to make it here today. And I'm here to testify on behalf of both Dakota County and the Minnesota Inter-County Association in support of the creation of the three new employment services. The new services will make individualized integrated employment accessible for a far greater number of people with significant disabilities in Minnesota who want to work. The new services will ensure that we are meeting the requirements of the HCBS settings rule, WIOA, the ADA, the Minnesota Olmstead Plan, and the Employment First Policy, which are federal and state-level directives mandating that if people want to work in an integrated setting, we need to direct funding and services to support them to do so. The Minnesota Office of the Legislative Auditor released a report this year on the financial oversight of home and community-based services. The report notes that Minnesota needs to improve our ability to improve our ability to support people with disabilities to work and live in integrated settings, and that Minnesota is significantly lacking in the area of providing integrated employment services currently. What we hear every day from people and families in Dakota County is that people want to work in integrated settings. In Dakota County, I personally am currently meeting with all students as they're leaving the school system in June that have significant disabilities. So far, I've met with 34 families. 33 of them are planning for integrated employment. This is an incredible sea change from what we've experienced in previous years. But we also hear from these families that it's really difficult and complicated for them to access services necessary to support them in their employment goals. So we currently have employment services available that are only working for a very small portion of people with disabilities, 13%, who are accessing vocational or day services in Minnesota. Through several pilot projects we have been running in Dakota County to increase employment outcomes with people with disabilities, we have learned that the more we focus on informed choice, the key word in all of this, where we let people and their families know that integrated employment is something they can choose. When we talk to them about what employment would look like in their lives and explain how their benefits would be impacted, the more we see people that are choosing employment over segregated work. We are finding many more people that want to work than are currently working today. One of the pilots we ran in 2016 was in conjunction with the State Department of Vocational Rehabilitation Services and PROACT, which is the fourth largest state training and rehabilitation center in the state of Minnesota. It was called Way to Work. The concept was that we could get, if we got people good information about integrated employment, and we made those services available to anyone who said they wanted to pursue that route, an astonishing 125 people within that Egan Center, or 58% of those that were served in Egan, chose to pursue integrated employment. The National Court Indicator Survey, which asked people in DT&H across the state whether or not they wanted integrated employment, also showed that 58% of people in DT&H said they wanted to move to integrated employment. Interestingly, in the Way to Work pilot, we have also started to see cost savings once people go to work. In conclusion, of nearly 60%, and that number will likely grow as people go to work, of people currently want employment and employment services and supports, we need to design a system that really works for them as well. The new services create a clear path to move someone from school or DT&H to employment by breaking down the planning process and the service components necessary to do so, and very importantly, ensuring an informed decision-making process, as well as incenting the development of system capacity to build those services. These services would allow all of us to ensure an equitable service delivery system where all people are able to get their needs met in a way that would make sense for them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Eilinger, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 1239? Seeing none, questions from members for the bill author? Final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House Bill 1239 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House Bill 1239 as we refer to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Albright. And with that, members, we will stand in recess until 6 p.m. tonight in Room 200. We'll see you then. The Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come back to order. First up on the agenda for this evening is House File 481, Representative Keel. Representative Keel moves that House File 481 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Keel, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today, I'm bringing forward to House File 481, and we have... This is really to deal with people with complex disabilities and the challenges of finding qualified staff. And I think this has some real promise in helping people with disabilities seek and attain and retain qualified staff. But with that, Mr. Chair, we also have an amendment.
Representative Keel moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The amendment.
I have with me Mr. Jeff Bangsberg, who brought this bill to me a while ago now, and I'm going to let him explain exactly what we're doing here.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bangsberg. If you could please state your name for the record and tell us about the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bangsberg, and I'm here as an advocate. In regards to the amendment took out the language on a PCA or CNA registry for personal care assistance to try to obtain. That was at the request of with the consultation of the Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. It was just too hard to obtain for caregivers, and we have replaced it with other language that has basically inserted must be trained as nursing assistants or home health aides, or have an equivalent amount of training, competency, and experience. And this will thus make it a little bit easier for direct care staff to obtain that type of training in this particular situation.
All right. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 481 as amended would establish a complex level of a PCA service, which requires a higher level of training and is reimbursed at that increased rate. A PCA is assisting people with disabilities who require 10 or more hours of service. PCA services per day would be paid a wage of at least 20% higher than other PCAs. To receive the higher wage, the PCA would have a proper training and be working with the person of complex needs. I want to stress that too. It's someone with complex needs. This would begin in July 1st of 2018. PCAs providing complex PCA services must be trained as nursing assistants or home health aides or having the equivalent amount of training, competency, and experience by providing lead time for up to 1 year. The amendment also allows PCA time to save money for tuition and complete the required training or competency testing. Disability advocates and state agencies are working to develop a hybrid of a nursing assistant or home health aide training with increased focus on the needs of people living at home. The bill, as amended, allows this type of alternative training, provided that it is compatible and state-approved. And with that, I think we'd like to hear from our testifiers, if that's possible.
All right. Mr. Banksberg, did you have any more?
Yeah.
All right.
Just a few more items. First of all, we didn't put a start date on our Mr. Chair's member of the committee. We did not have a start date as far as the rate increase. So we do have a certain amount of qualified professional or the agency supervising nurse must make sure that they can adhere to the care plan. And then we give that training up to a one-year lead time for that to develop. But it's up to you to determine when the start time will be. But just to go back and explain that typically personal care assistants receive between $10 or $12 per hour right now. I think you heard great testimony this afternoon for those of you who are in the finance committee about direct care staff needing wage increases. What we're talking here is for people who are very, very high level needs clients, and there are two here today that will talk about their stories and why, how important it is. These are guys that live in their own home, live in their own apartment, and they rely on direct care staff to help them in their own home and their own apartment as opposed to like a group home or some other type of facility. This program has been most cost effective. We do support an increase for all caregivers, but these particular individuals that have 10 or more hours of care, and once when I was on the program, I qualified for 9. And so if it gives you kind of a visual cue, I can drive my van, I can negotiate things with my hands a little bit, I can feed myself, I can wash my face and stuff, and the guys to my right cannot. And they'll talk about that a little bit more in detail. So it is a much higher level amount of care that's needed and attention that's necessary for people to be with them at all times. Therefore, it's very difficult to find people in this day and age to help these individuals out. And this community is at greater risk of getting institutionalized or worse yet, hospitalization, or even worse. I don't like to go down that road. But I'll answer any technical questions after we hear from the testimonies.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, my name is Carla Freese, F-R-I-E-S-E. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I grew up on a farm near Folda, Minnesota. It's south of Marshall. At age 16, I acquired a spinal cord injury, leaving me paralyzed from my shoulders down. I have received PCA services for 36 years, and I currently qualify for 12 hours of care per day. I need total assistance with all my cares. I cannot feed myself, open doors, drive. I'm diabetic. I use a BiPAP machine at night, and I have wound care issues. So my cares are specialized and complex. I lived in rural Minnesota for 15 years. I attended college at Marshall and Mankato, and I lived off campus and managed my own PCA staff. if urban areas are experiencing staffing shortages, it's likely to be even more severe in greater Minnesota. Upon moving to Hopkins, I was employed as a staffing coordinator at a home care agency for 12 years. I've noticed as the economy and job market improves, it becomes harder to find caregivers, especially for people with the most complex care. Those of us with disabilities find ourselves compromising our health and our well-being to accommodate our caregivers. I've allowed PCAs to bring their children, to be late, be on their phone, and let my cares be shortened in order to have any caregiver at all. Consequently, we end up burning out our faithful and reliable care workers just trying to function. I cannot hold a full-time job, catch my Metro Mobility rides, or participate in my community if I do not have a reliable caregiver to get me in and out of bed every day. It's disheartening to see that fast food workers get paid better than your caregivers. For example, my full-time caregiver has over 30 years experience as a caregiver and is paid $11.27 an hour. Their salary has increased only 77 cents in the last 10 years. Most are not paid PTO or holiday pay, and they receive minimal benefits. PCAs only receive raises when the home care agencies they work for receive an increase in reimbursement. Also, they get paid the same rate for assisting those who have fewer cares per day as they do for assisting those who have higher levels of care. I live in a handicap apartment building right now. The past winter holidays proved to be a staffing challenge, and many managed on minimal care. A neighbor told me she spent many weekends in bed because of lack of PCAs. She was told that she may have to go to the ER to be admitted into the hospital over Christmas due to inadequate staffing. The scenario was avoided, but she is now looking for other living arrangements, which may leave her less independent. I personally, on a personal note, it took me 5 months to replace the PCA. I had to let go for theft. Many of us with disabilities find our current staffing situations very stressful. Some are feeling depressed and helpless about their situation and are fearful of their future. Lastly, this crisis is overlooked and legislature hesitates to act. The consequences could be catastrophic for vulnerable Minnesotans with disabilities. I urge you to respond quickly and to support House File 481. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Freese, for your testimony this evening. Who else do we have testifying for you tonight to represent Akil?
Don is here. Get the mic so he can speak.
Bless you. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, my name is Don Bania. B as in boy, A-N-I-A. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Bania from Rogers. I was thrown into the unwanted world of a quadriplegic in the summer of 1970 when a 60-year-old drunk driver named Olaf Dahl turned into my lane while I was out enjoying a motorcycle ride on West Lake Street headed towards Lake Calhoun. With no time to stop, the motorcycle slammed into the car, hurling me over the handlebars and into the car's roofline. Fortunately for me, Minnesota at the time had a helmet law that saved my life. However, the impact broke my neck, left me paralyzed from my shoulders down. Fast forward now to 1977, when PCA services were first offered to Minnesota to young adults with physical disabilities. What an exciting time that was, when we could leave rehab centers and health care facilities and live like anyone else, and when finding a PCA was as easy as putting an ad in the Minnesota Daily or on a local community board. But that was then, and this is now. Now, a person seeking work can find an easier job, making more money, flipping hamburgers at McDonald's or Burger King. And because of this, as well as, in my opinion, the lack of empathy, the physically disabled community has been devastated. Case in point, my friend Mike, a motivational speaker and health educator, whose tag phrase was, "I got the electric chair and lived to tell about it." However, sadly, Mike died this past September of pressure sores that started when his PCAs were not showing up, forcing him to sit in his wheelchair for nights on end, which ultimately forced him into a nursing home where he was bedridden for 15 months and ultimately died. I also have a friend named David in Detroit Lakes, who would not be alive today if it were not for his 83-year-old mother, who lives down the hall. David is allotted 22 hours per day, but rarely see those hours covered because of unreliable staff. I am one of the lucky ones where I have a live-in PCA who helps me 24/7. And at times, we have attempted to find support persons to relieve her workload. But the inquiries are never interested after they hear of the minimal pay. So in closing, early on in the PCA program, I qualified for 14 hours a day. But today I only get 11, which would disqualify me to receive the governor's complex care rate of 12 hours per day. So I urge you to support House File 41 and consider viewing the PCA program as if it were in intensive care unit on a respirator, and a decision has to be made to either pull the plug and deem it a good idea for its time but no longer relevant for today, or revive it back to health to bring vitality and hope to the disabled community. The decision is in your hands. Thank you so much for this time.
Thank you, Mr. Bania.
Bania.
Mm-hmm. Representative Keel, do you have anyone else who would wish to testify?
I don't believe so.
All right. Are there any questions from members for Mr. Bangsberg, Ms. Fries, or Mr. Bania? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really a question, but Mr. Bangsberg, I just appreciate that you are a true citizen advocate, and I know you visited with me, and I bet you visited with a lot of members and, you know, got us to understand something that wasn't entirely, you know, clear in the beginning, and I just think a lot of people really owe you a lot for doing that work, and I hope that we're able to fund it, and you know, I definitely think we want to revive the patient. We really do. And I hope that we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Romer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Keel, for this bill. It's great. And thank you to the testifiers. I do have a question for Mr. Bania. Are you an artist?
Mr. Bania.
Yes. I've learned how to draw with my mouth. And I've had 6 Christmas cards in the past of Courage Christmas cards. So I guess the answer is yes.
Representative Walmer.
I need the answer because I actually have a picture that you drew. I heard you speak, I don't remember where, but many, many years ago. And you had a picture. It's a scene of Christmas. It's a Christmas card scene with the manger. So it's beautiful, and I have it up every year. So it's nice to see you again, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for that, Representative Walmer. Are there any other members who wish to have any questions for these testify. Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 41? Seeing none, are there any final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am very encouraged by this conversation. Certainly need to make sure that we can get this passed and the governor signing it, because I think there is, as Representative Lohmer pointed out, that we have an artist in the group and their value is very important. We need to make sure that they can rely on the cares that they need and that they're given the dignity that they deserve. I would really appreciate your support for this bill.
With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 481, as amended, be agreed before the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 41, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to go out of order a little bit again. House File 1260, Representative Cornish. And there's going to take a little bit of time for the adjustment there. But House File 1260 is the bill that will be moving next. And I will move that House File 1260 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. House File 1260. All right, Representative Cornish, we have the bill in front of us. Welcome to the Health and Human Service Committee. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there's a DE-1-1 amendment today put on the bill.
All right, I will move the DE-1-1 amendment. Are there any questions for the amendment? All those in favor of the DE-1-1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Cornish, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 1260 is nicknamed the Yellow Line Bill, and it's from my home county. These folks are my workers and fellow workers and friends down there in the Blue Earth County, and this House File 1260 expands the already approved medical assistance service of the InReach coordination, and the InReach provides a short-term community-based case management service to address the needs of people who frequent the emergency departments. In many circumstances, these individuals may be better served by community-based services. What this bill does is expands the use of the InReach coordination to focus on individuals who are detained by law enforcement, who historically have been incarcerated but may be better served through community-based intervention for their chemical and mental needs. And basically what all that means is these folks would be assisting the folks in the jail in kind of a screening process. And people that I talked to some veterans today and other groups that there's sometimes when the people come to jails, they're a lot better served by going other places. And these folks are here to explain the law, the bill proposal better than I. So turn it over to them.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Phil Klaus. I'm Director of Human Services for Blue Earth County in Mankato. I would maybe draw your attention just to open on page 4 of the packet that you were given. It's a chart that basically is entitled A Strategic Shift, and I am going to just do a really quick orientation to what our project is about using this slide before I hand it over to my colleague to provide some more detailed pieces of the bill. You'll see on this slide that our typical law enforcement interaction at this point includes options for law enforcement professionals for the jail, detox, and the hospital. What we are doing is trying to bring in another important element to increase the options, and you'll see that in the gray boxes, including diversion options, which then spreads out to the yellow boxes of all kinds of different things that a law enforcement professional can consider in addition to those three traditional options that they have currently. The orange box talks about a really important piece of our project, which is stabilization, assessment, and triage, to really try to slow things down and give both the people involved in an interaction with law enforcement as well as the officers themselves some time to consider their options as well. And so that's a very important element in what we're offering up in this bill today. I do have just three bottom lines that I want to offer to the chair and the committee here. And first of all, I thank Representative Cornish for his support throughout this entire process. We do have complete support from our local elected officials in our area and in our region. The first bottom line that I just offer you is I think this committee, the elected folks in our state, expect us to innovate. And so this is an example of innovation. It is something to add to the current pie and obviously address a big issue in our communities, as we all know, which is the chemical health and mental health elements that come to our jails. We have an overcrowding problem, and we have a triage problem. So that's number one. Number two, I would just point out to the committee that law enforcement do need more options, and we talk about pivot points, that law enforcement needs a chance to pivot with someone, and in this case it's a social worker, and my colleague will talk about the component of the bill that's specific to our efforts today. And they also need a pivot place, and so there's a pre-booking area in our jail. There's community crisis centers in communities that can act as options rather than incarceration. And so that's really the second major element of our project. And then finally, social services has a role to play. We have, to be really candid, sometimes taken a blind eye to the population in the jails. We have a plate full. I think there's no doubt about that. But we really do believe that we need to work together collaboratively in an integrated fashion with law enforcement. And this partnership in our community with our Sheriff's Department and the Mankato City Police Department has gone extremely well, lots of common ground, very easy time negotiating about where we're headed. So finally, I just want to say to all of you that that's kind of the general sense of our project, what we're up to. There's a specific component that we're asking your support for today, and we again want to thank our local representatives, Representative Cornish, certainly all of our elected officials, and DHS, who has been very supportive of this process throughout its course. Thank you very much for listening to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Clausen, for your testimony this evening. Ms. Youngerberg, welcome back to the committee. If you could please state your name once again for the record and present your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I am the Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services. I'm testifying tonight on behalf of MICA. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you to Representative Cornish for authoring this very important bill. So I'm going to provide a little bit of a technical look at this bill. It's post-arrest community-based service coordination. So post-arrest, prior to incarceration, offering an alternative to community-based care. This doesn't exist right now. The closest thing that exists that is what we've modeled this off of is the current emergency department medical service coordination that exists in some hospitals across the state. So we would expand on that premise, and it shares the same end goal as the original language from the emergency department medical service coordination. The goals are to really reduce unnecessary admissions to a higher level of care, replace it with community-based services, and immediate interaction where you can replace with community-based services. And it's really an alternative to the revolving door that we see all too often, and we see it especially in our jail system. So this is not a jail-embedded service. So this happens right outside of the jail, basically right outside of the jail. It's community-based. If it were in the jail, federal law prohibits Medicaid dollars to be used when a person is detained. So this is adding to the benefit set. This is that community-based service, and as you visualize it, think of it, you know, right in front of that jail, of the, you know, the door of the jail. So how does this work? If you turn to the sixth slide in your packet, it's called risk assessment process. It looks like this. I will very quickly move us through this. This is color-coded. Anything in blue, law enforcement has a responsibility. Anything orange is jail and courts, and anything yellow is where this new service would come into play, and we would say that human services or a community-based provider is responsible. So there's a community intervention. A person gets arrested. They're transported to pre-booking in a jail setting. There's an interview that happens, history, health screenings for mental health, chemical health, and physical health by a care coordinator. Law enforcement and this coordinator have a negotiation and talk about what might be the best course. The best course might be jail for that person. It just might be based on the charges. But there are many charges in which that could be negotiated and replaced with a community-based service. So at that point, law enforcement has a decision to make. And this whole project rests on the fact that law enforcement has full discretion. They may be booked into jail. If charges are held in lieu of incarceration, the person would enter into an individualized contract for diversion. And this is the interesting part of this bill. This bill would allow 60 days of care coordination into the community for human services to follow that person to see if they did follow through with their plan or not, to encourage them to provide options and to work with them for 60 days. At the conclusion of whatever that plan would be, care coordinator would communicate back with law enforcement to let them know if they successfully completed or not. If not, law enforcement would have the discretion to go back and look at the charges again, the initial charges. DHS has worked collaboratively with us to smooth out the finer details of this bill. Their technical assistance has been significant, and we so appreciate it. This is also subject to federal approval. In closing, law enforcement judges and attorneys and our staff tell us that people end up in jail simply because there are no alternatives. This bill moves resources as far upstream as possible and still maintains law enforcement discretion. For some offenses, this allows people a quick and voluntary path into treatment instead of an unproductive and lengthy stay in jail. We're certain that the individual and systemic benefit of adding the service will far outweigh any costs. Thank you all for your time very much, and we will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Berg, for your testimony this evening. Are there any questions for Mr. Clausen or Ms. Youngerberg? Representative Liebling.
Good evening. Thank you very much for this really interesting proposal, and thank you, Representative Cornish. It's great that you're thinking along these lines, and this sounds very promising. I'm just wondering, well, as I'm looking at the bill, it seems like what you're really just doing is adding a benefit. You're not requiring anybody to use it. And there is some kind of a report in here so that we would, you know, this is kind of a new thing, and it seems like we would get back some information about how it's being used and so on. You're probably thinking about using it in your jail, but have you had conversations with other law enforcement people across the state about whether they think this would work? I just think about, you know, when they're bringing somebody in that they just arrested them, let me just ask this. Where would this case manager person be if they're not in the jail? Surely they're not stationed there 24/7. So how does that piece of it work? Where is this person? And, you know, I assume they're kind of on call or, you know, how is all that going to play out? And that's one piece. And then the second piece is just what kind of response you've gotten. Is this something that you think that it'll be widely taken up by people across the state?
Mr. Clausen.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your questions, Representative. I'm going to answer some of this, and if the chair is okay, ask Angie to also fill in some of the gaps. To your earlier comments about this particular bill, we are very much interested in the long term, and in the long term we need a stability of funding to really pay for what is a social service staff that will be at the front end of the jail, and I will address your other question to that as well. And so it really is a funding stream, just as you suggest. It does exist for hospitals now, for a social worker in a hospital, mm-hmm. So it really does just tail right along with what exists. that is about the stability of the funding going forward. I'm going to have my colleague talk about just the other projects that are, the other parts of the state that are interested. We certainly have been in a partnership with the Department of Human Services, and their full expectation is that we will build something that's replicable. It will not be one size fits all. I think it needs to be customized to each community, depending on how the jail is set up, the sheriff's department, who the elected official is in that community. All of those things definitely matter. I will just say in general that there has been a great groundswell of interest, just because it is a win-win situation in that we're really relying on law enforcement to hold the cards and to make the important decisions at the front end. As far as the physical location, Angie might want to talk about this as well, but we do have the area in our jail specific to our situation that's called pre-booking. And so it is a vestibule that's between, and many of you know what the sally port is, where the vehicles come into a jail. It's a spot right there where the law enforcement does actually complete their paperwork before they cross, here we go, the yellow line into the jail. So we actually have a yellow line right on that door that goes into the jail. So that's where our name comes from. And so we are saying we're doing this prior to incarceration as a choice, first from law enforcement. Certainly the individuals, as you suggest, too, would have choices if they want to participate or not. None of this is, it's all voluntary. And so those are some of those key components. The other thing that we had not mentioned that's very essential is that there's been a heavy investment in mobile crisis response throughout the state of Minnesota. It exists throughout the whole state. And we do feel like we have to fully interface with that. That is 24/7. This needs to be 24/7. I would say law enforcement will not use this if we don't have a 24/7 offering. So it's going to take us, we've been at this really a couple of years, it's going to take us another year to really try to get to that place, and we're going to need to use our mobile team to be part of that mission. Thank you. Ms. Gingerberg.
Thank you. Just want to clarify, yes, it's just adding a benefit, and that it is voluntary both for the person and law enforcement. So if either says no, this isn't an option. And really it wouldn't work very well because we want people to voluntarily engage in this process. My colleague was describing slide 7 to you, and so we just have a schematic of what our pre-booking area looks like with the yellow line, and that's really what makes this constitutional rights change. The question of how widely would this be taken up, we've had significant interest across the state. We've had community meetings and continue to have community meetings, and as people are interested, we invite more and more colleagues from across the state. So specifically Region 3 and the Arrowhead region has expressed a lot of interest. We've also had individuals come from the St. Cloud area. Olmsted County has been a good partner with us in terms of communicating about what their programs are and ours. Carver County as well. And Otter Tail County has also expressed some desire to continue to learn. Then there have been additional inquiries that come from really all over the place. And so there's smaller inquiries that have come up, and that we continue to engage those individuals. Across our entire 10-county region, there is support both from Human Services and Sheriff's Department, from the Sheriff's Department. And from a timeline perspective, once we have this infrastructure built, we intend to share what it takes to bring this up with any of the counties that may be interested or jails that may be interested. And we would anticipate a 1 to 2 year development or ramp up for any other region or county that might be interested.
Representative Cornish.
All I was going to say, I was going to kind of short circuit some of the testimony and say to Representative Liebling, there's almost no counties that aren't interested once the information gets out there. I think you've seen in the media the unbelievable problems that we're having in jails with the mental health problems. Sheriff Stanek has been in the news many times, the mental health problems he's got there. And you could argue that anybody that goes to jail for any serious offense has some type of mental problems, but it's very pervasive, and I think this will be a huge help to our counties.
Representative Wigley.
Yeah, thank you. There might be ins and outs of this that we'll find out down the road. But I mean, I certainly think it's a great idea and effort, and hope it's successful.
Any other questions for the testimony?
Jardine, how much does this cost?
I think we've got a fiscal note here, a nominal fiscal note that will be addressed in your committee coming up.
Jardine, bring it with you.
And Mr. Chair, members, having been a jailer for 3.5 years and a law enforcement officer for 32 years, you don't know how depressing it is when you're a jailer and you get these people in and you hear them scream all night and bang their heads on padded cells and there's nothing you can do. And having to throw these people in jail and then leave as a law enforcement officer knowing that this isn't the place for them to be and that there's a better place for them to be. So I'm hoping you'll consider an alternative and invest in this yellow line and help these people out. So thank you very much.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1260? Seeing none, any final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Cornish.
That's good. I'm good. Thank you.
All right, with that, I'll renew my motion on House File 1260. As amended, we refer to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1260 as amended is we refer to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
Thank you,
Representative Cornish. All right, next we will take up Representative Albright and House File 846. Representative Albright moves that House File 846 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Albright, when you're ready.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. House File 846, I'm pleased to bring before you, it is the Unlocking Opportunities legislation. This bill creates a statewide competitive grant program to be administered by DHS that will benefit Minnesotans who find themselves locked out of opportunities for affordable, stable housing because of previous felony convictions. It's not another new program, because organizations that already work with this population can apply for grant funding. Grant awards will support delivery of affordable housing that's integrated with supportive services such as employment training and placement, health care, including mental health, independent living skills, and services that reconnect and build family ties. In other words, housing and services that will help these individuals thrive and contribute to their communities and break the costly cycle of incarceration. It's appropriate that this bill is being heard today on Homeless Day on the Hill, as the advocates from Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative who are here tonight know this is a fresh approach to a persistent challenge. No dedicated funding is currently available in Minnesota to provide housing and supportive services to individuals with felony convictions. The anticipated positive return on investment is worthy of the support of this committee. And with that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Eric Adams to speak further about the benefits of this legislation. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Adams, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, good evening, and thank you for this opportunity. My name is Eric Adams, and I am a volunteer leader with Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. Beacon is a collaboration of over 80 communities of faith and thousands of advocates working together to end homelessness. You have met many of these individuals at last month's Stay on the Hill or in the room in front of you. Beacon is active in developing affordable housing, providing emergency shelter, and advocating on affordable housing issues. We endorse the Homes for All legislative request. I speak in support of House File 846, named Unlocking Opportunities. Each year, approximately 8,600 Minnesotans are released from incarceration. These individuals are returning to every county in the state. Many are or will become homeless after release. Nearly half the adults who are homeless in Minnesota have spent time in one of our correctional facilities. To have independent lives, individuals who have been incarcerated need many things. Foremost are a place to live and a job. Unfortunately, persons with a criminal record are often locked out of these very things. This legislation establishes a grant program patterned after the Homeless Youth Act, which will support community-based supportive housing services. The Department of Human Services, the state's experts on supportive housing services, will solicit proposals from organizations, evaluate them, and make awards as appropriate. The legislation supports evidence-based best practices and requires reporting on outcomes. Multiple demonstration programs have shown that supportive housing works, but there is simply not an existing pool of funds to provide supportive housing for people who have been in prison. This is a time when the right thing to do aligns with the financially prudent thing to do. Minnesota Management and Budget released their Results First report on adult criminal justice last December. This study reports that benefits exceeded costs for all the similar programs studied, with up to $11.40 in benefits for every dollar spent. I'd like to leave you with a story. A recent participant in one of these programs spoke to a gathering. He said, "I'm 29, and I paid taxes for the first time this year. So now when I see the police, I think they work for me. They're not looking for me." These programs have the power to transform lives. I would like to thank you for your support of Unlocking Opportunities.
Thank you, Mr. Adams, for your testimony this evening. Representative Albright, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Adams? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 846? Seeing none, final questions for the bill author. Final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 846 has been referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 846 has been referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Albright. Next up, we'll bring House File 1804, Representative Albright. Representative Albright moves that House File 1804 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have in front of us Representative Albright. Your bill.
Mr. Chair, before I proceed with an explanation of the bill, I would like to move the A1 amendment, if I could.
Representative Albright moves the A1 amendment. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment?
And Mr. Chair, just a brief explanation. It just changes and inserts an effective date for the bill itself.
All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We've heard some pretty compelling testimony on a number of bills over the course of the day, and this is not to be any less than that. This bill helps to strengthen a very important mental health service we have available here in Minnesota, Mental Health Crisis Residential Services. When an individual is experiencing a mental health crisis and feels they need a safe place where they can stay temporarily to cope with the crisis, Mental Health Crisis Residential Services are available throughout Minnesota. This service provides individual access to mental health services in a facility where they can stay for a few days until their mental health crisis is under control. Minnesota pays for the room and board costs of this service for eligible individuals. Currently, individuals and providers have to go through a lengthy paperwork process to access the state reimbursement for this CMHS. However, because this service is meant to be temporary, average stays of 3 to 5 days, the individuals accessing this service often haven't completed this lengthy paperwork process that generally involves back and forth communication with the county by the time they have completed their stay in the provider's mental health crisis program. As a result, the provider doesn't get reimbursed for providing this service. This bill minimizes the lengthy paperwork process that individuals and providers have to go through to access reimbursement for this service, and in doing so, will allow individuals and providers to focus on the most important task at hand, supporting the individual to work through their mental health crisis, instead of having to focus on complicated and time-consuming eligibility paperwork. Mr. Chair and members, I have Annie Simons with me to further explain the bill and answer your questions pertinent to her testimony. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Simons. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Annie Simons, and I'm here representing the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. As you just heard, right now here in Minnesota, when an individual is experiencing an acute mental health crisis and has made the decision to seek mental health crisis residential services from a provider, the staff at that provider organization begin to provide individualized mental health services, and they also then begin to work with the individual to fill out and send into the county the necessary paperwork for securing reimbursement for the service. The Crisis Mental Health Services Room and Board portion is funded through Group Residential Housing, or GRH, which you all have been hearing about today in these hearings. The paperwork that must be filled out for GRH eligibility includes extensive and detailed questions involving bank account information and other documentation, and the individual filling out the paperwork is generally somewhere in the midst of an acute mental health crisis. However, staff work as best as they can to gather the necessary information, and then they send the paperwork to the county. However, I think we're all aware of the significant workload that a lot of our county caseworkers have right now, and therefore it's not uncommon for the county to take weeks to get back to the provider with what additional information or documentation verification might be needed to complete that payment eligibility process. And in other settings where GRH is used, the individual is generally accessing GRH for a prolonged period of time. So the fact that there might be a little bit of lag time, a few weeks of going back and forth with the county to figure out eligibility verification process pieces to access that GRH funding, that's not as significant of a problem in those situations. But for mental health crisis residential services, those are different in that the average stay is only around 3 to 5 days. So by the time the provider hears back from the county about what additional documentation might be needed, such as bank statements or other pieces, the individual has often completed their stay with the provider and has moved on. And the provider then has to decide, do they use limited staff time to try to track down the individual and the needed paperwork, or do they simply forego payment for the services they provided to that particular individual? So, put simply, we have a situation where in some instances today, after the provider has provided these crisis mental health services, they are denied payment, not because the individual served wouldn't have been determined eligible, but because the lengthy and administratively burdensome eligibility verification process just doesn't align very well with the temporary structure of this program. So the bill before you today, what it does is it says if someone is receiving medical assistance, it's assumed that they're eligible for a GRH payment for this very specific service, this mental health crisis residential service lasting about 3 to 5 days on average. And by targeting this presumptive eligibility for GRH funds to those who access both medical assistance and mental health crisis residential services, we believe we're effectively targeting the funds to low-income Minnesotans who are coping with a serious mental illness, which is one of the purposes of GRH funds. The streamlining change of presuming eligibility that's proposed in this bill, as Representative Albright said, it will help increase access to this critical crisis mental health service, and it will allow providers and the individual accessing the service to focus very exclusively on addressing the mental health crisis at hand. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Simons. Are there any questions for Ms. Simons? Seeing none, Representative Albright, do you have any other testifiers on this bill?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1804? Final questions from members for the bill author. Final word, Representative Albright.
Yes.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 1804, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1804, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Albright. Next, we will take up House File 2304, Representative Franson. Representative Franson moves that House File 2304 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Franson, whenever you are ready.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I have a motion to refer to Health and Human Service Finance?
Yes, we've already made that one.
Okay, good. And then I have two amendments. I've got a DE1.
All right, Representative Franzen moves to DE1-1 amendment. Thank you. Are there any questions to the DE1-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1-1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE1-1 amendment is adopted. Representative Franzen.
And then, Mr. Chair, I have a oral amendment.
Representative Franzen, state your oral amendment.
So on line 2.15, strike rulemaking. The commissioner shall adopt rules to implement this section.
So the oral amendment is to strike all of line 2.15.
Mm-hmm. And insert a handheld dental X-ray registrant shall otherwise comply with Minnesota Rules Part 4732.
Okay. Ms. Clarkfest, could you please restate the oral amendment for us?
Mr. Chair and members, if I could just make a couple technical changes to the oral amendment. We'll keep subdivision 4, and then the head note will read compliance with rules. And then the amendment will read a registrant using handheld dental X-ray equipment shall otherwise comply with Minnesota Rules, Chapter 4732.
Representative Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair, this seems like a pretty extensive oral amendment, and I know that there's a 24-hour rule in this committee, and this, what I just heard, it refers to another section of law, this is going to another committee. So I wonder, you know, this isn't just like, you know, correcting a minor technical mistake, which is usually what an oral amendment would be. So I wonder if the chair is waiving the 24-hour rule.
So can I explain?
I want to hear their justification for this first. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. The language is agreed upon by DHS because they don't need to make new rules. Existing rules in 4732 cover this bill. And so that's why we're doing the oral amendment. Simplifies things up a little bit. So I just thank you for your indulgence.
Yeah, we'll waive the rule on the 24-hour rule for this.
Thank you.
To the oral amendment.
So I've explained that already.
Ms. Clarkfest, could you please restate the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, on page 2, line 15, we'll strike everything after 4, period, and insert compliance with rules, a registrant using handheld dental X-ray equipment shall otherwise comply with Minnesota Rules, comma, Chapter 4732, period.
Are there any questions to the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Franzen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. At the rate of medical advancement, as the rate of medical advancement continues to grow, we must occasionally work with regulators to ensure that proven technology is not prohibited in our state. House File 2304 addresses an X-ray technology currently used in all but 3 states, Minnesota being one. Although Minnesota doesn't strictly prohibit the device, the paperwork associated with its use makes its use all but impossible. My simple goal with this bill is to allow dentists who would like to use this a device a way to do so. We have been working with the department, and this language represents our conversations thus far. With me to explain the device, its safety, and its appropriate use is Mr. Scott Hayden.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hayden. If you would please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and members. My name is Scott Haddon. I'm a product manager for Revex and Cable Care that produces the some handheld dental devices. I'd like to, the committee could refer to the second slide in the handout that I have. It says ADA FDA excerpt.
Proceed.
Yes, sir. If we go down to the second paragraph, and I'll just read this really quickly on this, is dosimetry studies indicate that these handheld devices present no greater radiation risk than standard dental radiographic units to the patient or the operator. And the next paragraph is no additional radiation protection precautions are needed when the device is used according to the manufacturer's instructions. We've enjoyed working with the department, and they've been cooperating with us. I'd like to acknowledge that. And we've been trying to bring this into Minnesota. Our original product was introduced in 2006. Our first communications for approvals, widespread approval, was in October of 2006 with the department. And, you know, since then we've had some approvals, but it's very highly restricted. The onerous process of use makes it very difficult for clinicians to have access to the product. In Minnesota, there's over 2,300 dentists with yet only a handful of these devices. In North America, our company alone, we have 23,000 of these devices currently in use and have had since 2006. And as representative said, there's only three states that restrict the use to this level, Minnesota being one of them. And with that, I would really ask for the members to consider moving forward with this bill that will bringing this in line with many other states and also provide access to a product that is beneficial to the clinicians as well as patients. The device itself, when you're comparing it to the standard use of a what's called a wall-mounted device that's currently in use, we produce 25% less radiation that goes to the patient and a higher level of quality in the imaging that's been proven. We also have had no instances of any operators that have had an overexposure of radiation according to dosimetry uses in many states while using these devices properly. And with that, I would ask again the consideration for approving this bill to allow this use. I have a device with me. This is what this device is. It's very simple. It's easy to use for the clinician, and it's very safe.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Houghton, for your testimony this evening. Are there questions for the testifier? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is this using the same wavelength as the standard wall mount?
This actually uses DC current. This is battery-operated, which also reduces the overall dose to the patient.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was wavelength of your beam, not power source.
Mr. Houghton.
So, respectfully, I don't understand on wavelength what you're speaking to.
Representative Baum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it might be that we don't have anyone here that can detail it. Basically, the wavelength defines the energy level of the beam. It also impacts what kind of film and its sensitivity. And I was curious about the focus. I noticed in the materials you stated that you had to have the shield in place. If the shield wasn't in place, you had to have the lead apron. And I was curious what the material of the, you know, in the shield, if it was lead impregnated, if it used electromagnetic focusing. I'm just trying to understand the technology and reliability of that technology, since it's a handheld as opposed to a wall mount. And is that the type of thing that you could inform me on?
Yes. Mr. Houghton.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, go ahead.
As far as the focal spot of this device is a 0.4 millimeter. The protection that is provided by this is a lead oxide acrylic. So it is, as you had stated, that deflects any of the scatter radiation away from the operator at a 10 degree deflection at this, which is what creates the protective barrier around the operator when this issue is properly and held horizontally.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe the author could maybe point me to offline some technical information on the unit so I could review it before it hits the floor and I vote on it.
Good luck for you, Representative Franzen. Are there any other questions for Mr. Hodden? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 2304? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to hear from the Department of Health.
All right, if someone from the Department of Health could please make their way down. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Melissa Finnegan. I am the Director of Legislative Relations for the Department of Health. As Representative Franzen commented, this language does reflect conversations we've had with the stakeholders over the past year. So, Representative Liebling, if you have questions, I'll do my best to answer them, but I might need to phone a friend for some technical expertise.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was kind of curious to know whether Representative Franzen could answer Representative Quam's questions. But maybe, you don't think you could answer them either, huh?
Absolutely not.
Technical experts are shaking their heads. So we'll have to look into that and get back to Representative Quam. All right. But my question really, though, the serious question is, even I know you've been working on this, and the advocates have told me they've been working with the department on this, but is the department satisfied with the bill, and is this something that the department feels is appropriate for use? And, there are a lot of, I think, good reasons why this might be a thing to add to our, available resources in the state, and are there still remaining issues that you can tell us what they are?
Ms. Finnegan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the department is comfortable with the language as it stands.
Okay.
Representative Liebling. Any other questions for the department since she's down here? Seeing none, final questions for Representative Franzen? Final word, Representative Franzen?
Nope.
With that, Representative Franzen renews her motion that House File 2304 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails in House File 2304 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Franzen. All right, next up we have Chair Dean with House File 1730. And as he makes his way forward, Chair Dean moves that House File 1730 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. We have the bill in front of us, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'd also like to move the DE-1 amendment.
Chair Dean moves the DE-1 amendment. Are there any questions to the DE-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE-1 amendment signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The DE-1 amendment is adopted. Representative Dean, to your bill.
Thank you. The DE-1 amendment removes language as introduced, makes changes that reflect the changes on the Senate side. This deals with pediatric extended care centers. And what it does is it changes the ability to be able to care for kids with three kids with a single care provider. It's a new kind of a model, but what this would do is it would allow us to be able to free up very expensive beds and also to be able to provide care in a safe setting for children. The three pediatric home care nurses can care for three medically complex children in three homes. The nursing agency is paid for each nursing hour. In this typical arrangement, one nurse could care for up to three children, so you could see the obvious ability to save lots of dollars, free up even more expensive beds for medically complicated children. So that's what the bill does, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions. We also have Cameo Zender, who will be able to answer any technical questions that we may have about the specific proposal.
All right. Are there any questions for Chair Dean on House File 1730? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Dean, I think this is a promising idea. And because we've heard a lot about this pediatric home care and the difficulty of getting qualified staff and, you know, the staff that are working in the hospitals, you know, at least have some support people around them, and then they go into a person's home and they're on their own, and it's, we need, like, more qualified people than even in the hospital, it seems like. So I like this idea, but I have a little trouble visualizing how this works. I see it's daycare or it's extended care or daycare. So, is it intended that this would be sort of a, sort of maybe almost like a specialized kind of child care where a parent would bring the child there for the day while the parent is at work? Or, you know, how do you see this working as a practical thing?
Journey.
Sure. This is extended care centers, so that would provide just for medically complex kids. And the model would improve access for families seeking an alternative to prolonged neonatal intensive care. So this is in lieu of hospital care. So this would be a new model. We haven't seen this before in Minnesota. I think it has been tried in other states, including Florida, Texas, New Jersey, Delaware, Mississippi, Kentucky, Arkansas. But it has been tried in other states, and what it does is it just simply allows for those very highly trained people to be able to care for more kids in lieu of expensive hospital beds. So that's what it does. In terms of a licensing, it would be not trying to dislodge a currently existing plan. And if you had questions about the specific payment, we could bring somebody down on that. But that's just pretty much the cartoon diagram of it, is that that's what it is. I think it has some pretty good benefits, a lot of upside for cost savings. And also, as you point out correctly, Representative Liebling, the complexity of care in many of these instances is really something. So if you've had a chance to visit a medically complex in-home care situation in your district, then I would encourage everybody who hasn't to do so. It kind of takes you aback a little bit when you see how complicated, and we've had some testimony from parents and from caregivers in the committee. And one of my favorite testifiers, I forget who it was, but he was talking about when he first started caring for folks, and he walked in and there was a kid with incredibly complicated needs, and he had a ventilator and all of this equipment, and here he is in this house, and it's kind of off-putting. He said, are you sure you're supposed to be doing this? And the family was like, yep, we're safe, we're good. We're providing really good care. So that's the diagram of where we're heading on this, and I think it shows some promise.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Dean, is the idea that as the patient comes out of the hospital, they go here to sort of to stay 24 hours a day, or could it be maybe it's could be that or a respite sort of situation, or that's all. I'm just trying to get a sense of how this works. Is sort of an intermediate stop before they then go home?
Sure. Patients want to be able to discharge from hospitals, but they can't oftentimes because they don't have a level of care to the next place. So this would, in the case of complex pediatric cases, this would displace extended hospital stays. So it would be a step down from a pediatric intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. So that's the solution. We don't really know exactly what the savings would be, but I think they could be very significant and also free up very, very expensive space in our hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Representative Lulee.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Dean. And I'm wondering if Cameo could also come down just for a couple questions from Pediatric Home Services.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Cameo Zender, and I am General Counsel and Chief Operating Officer with Pediatric Home Service. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Ms. Zender, we were talking a little bit about this new model and what it would look like, and I've had a chance to talk with you a little bit about that as well. So we understand that there are kids that are being discharged from the hospital to home for home care nursing services, and those nursing services may be for some duration of time for that child's life as they're improving, right?
Correct.
And we have a shortage of nurses doing home care nursing, and so this idea, as I understand it, is a place for multiple of those sick children to come and spend part of a day, or is it usually day by day by day, or is it extended care like overnight care? Can you just describe a little bit more about the utility of this for families and for the well-being of the kids?
Ms. Zender.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for the question. This is not intended to be a residential facility. This would have a maximum number of hours per day, or perhaps on average per week, equaling about 14 hours per day. So the purpose here is to increase access to home and community-based services so that, as you have well articulated, and we appreciate your recognition, that we do have a scarce resource in nursing. So we want to make sure we are best allocating that resource by providing care to more patients, more children in the center environment than we are able to in a home.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple more questions, Ms. Zender. So when you envision this center, how many children do you think might be there on a day-to-day basis? What would be the scope of this from your perspective?
Ms. Zender.
That may vary very much by the individual entity that's running the center. We believe that there is a need for services that would support multiple centers throughout even just the metropolitan area, providing services to 30-plus children on a daily basis.
Mr. Chair, when I have been talking about this idea with some of my colleagues, they have logistical questions like, how does a family move a sick child from home to a facility like this, and is that a barrier for the family? Can you just talk a little bit about that experience?
Ms. Zender.
Certainly. The families that we work with really are quite accustomed to transporting their children, just as any of you as parents have become accustomed to transporting your children. This is their daily lives. We will be looking at using the ability to use some of the non-emergent medical transportation, should that be available, and working out those logistics. So we would see this as a combination of transportation provided by the center, as well as coordinating that with families as appropriate.
Representative Murphy.
And then just one last question. I'm looking at the handout that you provided, or the organization provided. I'm looking at the hourly rate between center care and home nursing care, and of course those are different. That's probably where some of the cost savings are occurring, because there's a differentiation. So can you help us understand how you get to the hourly rate of $39.15 for nursing care in a center versus in a home?
Ms. Zender.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that $39 and change is calculated looking at the proposed increased home care nursing rate, which would be a 25% increase to the current home care nursing reimbursement, and then taking a 25% discount from that. To be clear, these services are billed per recipient, not per nurse. The cost savings, again, occurs, I would say, in multiple ways. One being that we would be providing an equivalent quality of service to an individual patient at 25% less than that service would be charged in the home, as well as, again, increasing access to services, which means we get more kiddos out of the hospital and into, again, an equivalent quality of care, but at a much lower reimbursement rate.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Zender? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1730? Seeing none, any final questions for members for the bill author? Final word, Representative Dean.
Thanks for the committee time. Appreciate it.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 1730, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1730, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Chair Dean. Next up, Representative Zerwas, House File 1406. As he's making his way down, Representative, I will move that House File 1406 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Zerwas, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I think there's an A1 amendment in your packet, Mr. Chair. Do you move that bill?
I will move the A1 amendment. Are there any questions for the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. With the late hour, I'll be brief. House File 1406 is brought to us by Stepping Stone, a homeless shelter in Anoka County that offers services. They're looking for a rate increase, and I have someone from Stepping Stone that can provide some more information about the services they provide and the rate increase requested.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Julie Jepson. I'm the Development Director for Stepping Stone Emergency Housing. You can't choose your parents. You can't choose where you were born, but you can choose what you do with it. Choose your future. Choose to go above and beyond. Choose to show up to work early. Choose to be indispensable. The more hard choices you make, the better your life will be. These statements were made by Senator Abler to our residents when he and Representative Whalen visited Stepping Stone in the fall. Stepping Stone works with our residents to see that future, to believe in themselves, to develop a strong work ethic, encouraging them that no matter what they do in this life, to not shy away from their hardships, but to embrace them and become stronger because of them. Stepping Stone is the only homeless shelter in Anoka County. We provide emergency housing and support to 66 youth and adult individuals ages 18 and older who are experiencing homelessness as they strive toward self-sufficiency. We are a highly unique homeless shelter, which at a bare minimum doesn't make our residents fight for their bed at night and kick them out the next day. Instead, we are their short-term home. Residents live at Stepping Stone in a dormitory-style setting, participating in required janitorial and cafeteria-style work chores, as you and I do in our own homes. In addition, they are required to take academic courses on workforce training, job skills training, computer and technology, and financial literacy, as well as adult basic education assessments. We also have healthcare professionals from Alina who monthly volunteer their time to provide our residents with their current and preventative healthcare needs. In addition, we have a dental van that comes every other month. We have intentionally created Stepping Stone to be a safe, secure, and healing place for those experiencing homelessness so that they will never need to experience it again. As Stepping Stone, we help those who want to help themselves because they can't do it on their own. And just like our residents, we too cannot find success without help, and we need your help. I'm here this evening asking for that help and in support of House File 1406.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jepson, for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Jepson? Representative Cagle.
Not a question, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas, thank you for taking this bill on. I had the opportunity to tour Stepping Stones and been working with Ms. Jepson, and I'm just really impressed. And so thank you so much for your hard work. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Jepson? Representative Rudwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we adopt the A1?
Yes.
We did. Okay. So I'm just looking at that language. It's really more probably for Representative Zerwas. Could you just sort of explain why we need to do that, notwithstanding any other law or rule to the contrary? Anoka County is not responsible for any additional costs associated with the supplemental rate provided for in the subdivision. What supplemental costs might we be putting on Anoka County if we didn't have this in the bill?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think this is the belt, suspenders, and cummerbund of legislation. I think this is the comfiest of comfort languages. Anoka County was a little concerned that a rate increase might have some local costs back out of the county. I didn't think that that would be applicable, but just to make everyone feel snugly, we decided to add this in.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, thank you. I think I hit on a sore point here.
No. It's late.
Okay, so I just was wondering that just maybe for general reasons. I just wonder if there's anybody here who knows what possible costs those would be. I'm just curious why they would worry about what it would be they would worry about with this, because we're doing this in a lot of other places, too.
Any ideas, Representative Zerwas, and who could help us with that? Ms. Jepson.
Thank you. I believe, as I agree with Representative Zerwas, it's a very, very interesting security net that they're adding to this amendment. We are working with DHS right now on actively amending some of the dollar figure in the amendment from $700 to the standard rate, which is our original intent. And I believe that the county was very concerned about the difference between that standard rate and the $700, and they didn't want to eventually be responsible for that difference. Again, in our opinion, in working with DHS, they would never be responsible for that. But again, confirming what Representative Zerwas said, it's just a significant safety net.
Representative Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. If, for example, GRH funding is state funding,
right?
So it doesn't really, I guess, matter what happens to Medicaid. But if the state, for some reason, later on decided that we couldn't afford it, is that the sort of situation I guess what I'm wondering is, does this language prevent Anoka County from taking over if it chooses to do that at some point? If, for example, the state said, we just can't keep funding this program, can Anoka County pick it up if it, at that point, wants to?
Ms. Jepson.
Honestly, I'm not aware of that, but I believe we'd work closely with DHS to figure that solution out.
All right, Representative Liebling.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1406? From the audience. Final questions for Representative Zerwas. Final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think if you've seen the work that Stepping Stone does in the community with their emergency shelter beds, I had a group of homeless for all activists from Elk River in my office today that were down here for the homeless day on the hill, and they said if the stars perfectly align, they can refer one of their homeless youth to Stepping Stone if they happen to have a vacancy. And so it's a facility that's in high demand and high usage, and we need to do what we can to help the facility out.
With that, Representative Zerwas, I will renew my motion that House File 1406 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1406 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you.
Next up, I will move House File 464, Representative Zerwas. House File 464 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. There's a DE-1-2 amendment, if the Chair could offer that amendment.
I will move the DE-1-2 amendment, Representative Zerwas, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The DE1-2 amendment is the result of several weeks of discussion between interested parties, and so this is kind of the compromise language that was landed on.
Are there any questions for the DE1-2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1-2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE1-2 amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House Bill 464, which was originally designed to introduce a new mid-level provider into our home care space. The shortage of home care providers and home care hours is really staggering, and what that translates to is a lack of care and gaps in care and individuals getting care within their homes. One of the providers of the service, Accurate Home Care, it's a large provider which happens to locate their headquarters in my district, worked with DHS to quantify their numbers of hours in unfulfilled hours just over the last year. And it was thousands and thousands of unmet hours where they just simply couldn't provide care where there was care needed. And so we're looking at many things. We're looking at ways to recruit and retain LPNs and RNs, of course, but we're also looking for perhaps some new or innovative ways to address that home care shortage as well. House File 464, as amended, sets up a study to look into nursing workforce, home care nursing workforce shortage, and try to find the answer. I don't know the answer today, members, but I know the scope of the problem is quite staggering, and so I think it's something that we need to address that will be a crisis situation, if not already, certainly in the next few years.
All right. Are there any questions for Representative Zerwas? Do you have any testifiers, Representative Zerwas?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Zerwas, for bringing this to a study. What we have in nursing, right, we see shortages and overages over time, and we're facing a real issue here in Minnesota and other parts of the country. And I think it's right to ask the question, how do we fill these jobs and how do we make sure that people across the state, especially in greater Minnesota, are getting the care that they need? So right to ask the question and right to really examine it to see if we do need to find a way to work with and around licensure to fill that role, or if we need to fill the jobs with the people that aren't in them right now. And so I am grateful that you found this path, because I think it's important to answer the question, and this is the right way.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 464? Seeing none, any final questions from members for Representative Zerwas? Final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I hope this does begin to address and certainly pull in the key stakeholders that we need to address this issue.
With that, I remove the motion that House File 464, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 464, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Next up, House File 2177, Representative Zerwas. I will move that House File 2177 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Zerwas, two-year bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I do have a slight oral amendment to get the bill in the shape that we need to tonight. It's in consultation with the department. Unfortunately, this amendment did not make it off of my desk to the committee administrator's desk in time to meet the 24-hour rule. It's my fault and my fault alone. I can go over the oral amendment. It's pretty straightforward. It is to strike Section 4, Section 10, Section 11, and Section 16.
would you please call those numbers again, Representative Zerwas?
Yep, it's Section 4, Section 10, Section 11, and Section 16.
All right, and Representative Zerwas, why are you striking these?
Yep, it's my understanding that the sections being stricken are sections that there wasn't broad consensus on. As a housekeeping bill, we wanted to keep this non-controversial, and I think at least one of the sections is being struck at the request of the department.
All right. Are there any questions to the oral amendments? It will be repeated before we vote. All right. Representative Zerwas, could you please go through the oral amendment once again?
Yep. Not a problem. On page 3, section 4 is the exception to eyeglass prescription expiration. We would strike that. Section 10 on page 8 is income deductions. We would strike that. Section 11 on page 9, skilled and intermediate nursing care. We would strike that. And Section 16, on page 16, refusing readmission. We would strike that, Mr. Chair.
All right. All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2177 is a housekeeping bill that allows advanced practice registered nurses and physician assistants to complete the necessary paperwork for the care they are providing on a daily basis. This will eliminate delays and duplication of workforce caused by needing to find physicians to just simply sign a form for a patient that they would not have seen. It promotes transparency and accountability by recognizing documents from advanced practice registered nurses and physicians' assistants, and the language is non-controversial. We did get into one section about the eyeglasses. There was, I think, optometrists that were somewhat uncomfortable with that, so we just scratched the language. The bill is being supported by the Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota Board of Medicine, the Minnesota Board of Nursing, the Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Department of Health. And finally, Mr. Chair, there is no fiscal impact. And with that, I think I do have a testifier available to provide brief testimony or answer questions as needed by the committee.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Brian Goodroad. I'm with the Minnesota Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Coalition. I'm a nurse practitioner at the HIV and Infectious Disease Clinic at Hennepin County Medical Center. I just really wanted to provide two brief examples of how this bill would affect my day-to-day provision of care. And in one example, I saw an adolescent going to school, certified that the adolescent was free from tuberculosis, and the student and family took the form to school and were told that my signature was not sufficient. I was sent home from school that day and had to make another appointment and come back to get a physician's signature. So this would change that. Another example is in the provision of primary care to folks with HIV. I actually do a lot of diabetes care too, and a number of times I certify that somebody's on a diabetic diet for a place that they might be getting dietary services. And this would specifically allow an advanced practice registered nurse or a physician assistant to do that certification as well for the day-to-day primary care they're providing. And with those two examples, I just open it up to any other questions you might have as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Goodrow, for your testimony this evening. Are there questions for Mr. Goodrow? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can APRNs and PAs already do the certification a person needs to get a disability sticker on their car? I don't see that in here. I know we're just cleaning up language, so maybe that's already in law, but someone I think had mentioned that to me, that it was really hard to get that. You know, sometimes people have even a temporary condition where they need to be in the parking in the disabled spot.
Mr. Goodrow.
That's already part of statute. It has been for a number of years. APRNs, NPAs are specifically in statute to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any other questions for Mr. Goodrow? Seeing none, Mr. Goodrow, thank you for your testimony this evening. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2177? Seeing none, final questions from members for the bill author. Final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2177, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2177, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Okay, members, and briefly, as Representative Hamilton makes his way up for House File 1993, House File 1730 that we brought up before was originally sent to Government Operations, but because of the amendment, can now be referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. So Representative Dean moves to reconsider the motion to refer House File 1730 as amended to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is before us again, so Representative Dean now moves that House File 1730 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. And that is taken care of. Next, we have House File 1993, Representative Hamilton, and I will move that House File 1993 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hamilton. The bill is in front of us. When you are ready, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer up the A4 amendment at this time to get the bill in the shape we'd like to.
Okay, and I will move the A4 amendment. Are there any questions to the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, to your bill. As amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in essence of time, I will turn to the Commissioner and ask him to walk us through the bill and also let us know the need for this bill.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. First, I want to thank Representative Hamilton for authoring House File 1993. This is a department policy bill for the medical cannabis program. Today, Minnesota's medical cannabis program has provided over 6,000 Minnesotans with access to safe, independently lab-tested medicine dispensed by licensed Minnesota pharmacists. Our patients experience some of the most acutely severe and serious conditions. Just to give you an example of the kind of patient comments we hear, my son was only 8 years old. Thank you for the cannabis. I believed it helped him with his potential pain and nausea associated with his brain cancer. He had very little pain at the end. I believe even his hospice nurses were surprised at how little pain he had. Thank God for his painless passing. The only wish I had as a parent was a wish I could have gotten medical cannabis sooner. We're going to be issuing a report in the next couple of weeks detailing patient comments from several hundred patients that have all voluntarily, obviously not given any personal information, but submitted comments on the program. So this bill really protects program integrity and patient safety by improving and expanding on MDH's regulatory structure and our oversight of the two medical cannabis manufacturers. I'll just go through really briefly. In the beginning of the bill, you're providing MDH with a greater array of enforcement options over the manufacturers and variable fine amounts that would be proportionate to any violation. So under current law, enforcement penalties are really at either end. We're limited to a death penalty termination of a registration or alternatively a $1,000 fine. There's nothing in between. What you see in Section 1 is giving us access to what's called the HECA authority. It's existing law authority that we use for other healthcare sectors, other healthcare industries, and it's a graduated penalty authority that basically allows us to respond to violations in an increasing way if the violations aren't corrected. This brings the medical cannabis program into line with the way we treat other healthcare providers. In Section 2, we're clarifying data practices status for an unsuccessful manufacturer applicant's data. That's simply based on a recent district court ruling. It's also providing some narrow authority for employees of a third-party lab to collect and transport samples of medical cannabis for safety testing. We're also clarifying criteria and contested case hearing methodology for any re-registration of manufacturers and then establishing a process for revocation or non-renewal of the manufacturer. And that part is also, you see, in Section 3. Moving to Section 4, we're authorized to order the destruction of medical cannabis products when necessary to protect patient health and safety if, for example, we found some product that was contaminated for some reason. We're requiring manufacturers to use a tracking software for products, which they both already do. We're requiring notification for Department of Health for any manufacturer ownership change of 5% or more, and then a background check on the company's new owners. And that's just to make sure that a sale wouldn't happen, that we would be forced to deregister the manufacturer because the new owner couldn't pass a background check. We're clarifying that printed dosage labeling requirements on medication dispense are patient-specific. And then lastly, in the repeal section, Section 7, the bill is repealing our existing law authority for the $1,000 fine. That would obviously be unnecessary due to the new graduated enforcement authority. Really appreciate your consideration and support for this proposal, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Are there questions for Commissioner Pollack? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1993? Seeing none. Questions for the bill author?
Seeing none.
Final word, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chairman and members.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1993, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1993, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
That's it, right?
And with that, we are adjourned.